as we dig into the research around these lifelong bonds.
We'll even divulge some of our own stories too.
Siblings Unpicked starts this morning at 11. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
And this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday, the 1st of June. This is Today with Justin Webb and Anna Foster.
The headlines this morning: hundreds more official documents relating to the appointment of Lord Mandelson as US ambassador are to be published today, including messages between him and ministers described as embarrassing and cringeworthy. And the US and Iran say they've attacked each other's military bases. Kuwait says it's intercepting missiles and drones.
Also in today's programme, we'll take the temperature on the future of the NHS with the man who's just been given one of the toughest jobs in politics, that is the new health secretary, at 8:10. As news breaks overnight of fresh exchanges of fire in the Middle East, we'll try to make sense of the increasing Israeli incursion into Lebanon. But even in the darkest of times, there are still moments of hope.
They're saying how pretty I am.
That's the comedian Shappi Khorsandi, who told us last week on the programme about her wait to speak to family in Iran. And she'll tell us about the moment she reconnected with them after 8 o'clock. And joy on the streets of North London.
The noise of building Campioni's of shops.
Hundreds of thousands of fans celebrated Arsenal's first Premier League trophy in over 20 years. We'll be speaking to the club's CEO, Richard Garlick, about this season's achievements.
And before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
More than 1,000 pages of documents relating to Lord Mandelson's time as ambassador to the US are due to be released later today. They're expected to include text messages between ministers and the disgraced Labour peer. Senior government figures and civil servants lost their jobs over the appointment of Peter Mandelson, who was given security clearance despite concerns raised by vetting officials. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
The release of some of the Epstein files in the US revealed the extent of Lord Mandelson's friendship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein and led to his sacking. This tranche of documents, amongst the largest ever laid in Parliament, will give us details of the discussions around the peer's appointment, as well as an insight into his time as the UK's man in Washington. It will contain emails, briefings and memos, as well as pages of messages on what seems to be the government's preferred communications platform, WhatsApp. Senior government sources have conceded the tranche will include details of exchanges which are, in their words, embarrassing and cringeworthy. Lord Mandelson's vetting file will not be included. It's understood the Met Police have asked for it to be held back while they investigate him on suspicion of misconduct in a public office. He has denied wrongdoing.
Kuwait's military says its air defences have been intercepting missile and drone attacks. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps has said that it targeted a US airbase in response to an attack on Sirik Island in the south of the country. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yulan Nell.
This is the third known military escalation between the US and Iran in the space of a week. Kuwaiti state media reported that sirens were sounding across the country this morning. US Central Command then stated that it had carried out what it described as self-defense strikes at two Iranian drone command and control sites over the weekend. It said this was in response to what it called aggressive Iranian actions, including shooting down a US drone over international waters. The latest developments underline the fragility of the ceasefire between the US and Iran, as negotiators on both sides have appeared to edge towards a deal to extend it.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has spoken to the leaders of both Israel and Lebanon to try to de-escalate the conflict with Hezbollah. Israeli troops are pushing further north, seizing the 900-year-old Beaufort Castle. According to a US official, Mr. Rubio has proposed that as a first step, Lebanese officials should put pressure on Hezbollah to stop cross-border attacks, and in return, Israel would refrain from further escalation. Plans for a single patient record for the NHS in England will be debated for the first time by MPs today. The aim is to combine GP, hospital and social care data so people don't have to keep repeating their story at appointments and doctors can quickly get access to patient information. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
A&E doctors are frustrated that they sometimes can't get access to patients' GP records. Under this plan, they'll quickly be able to check complete histories, medication and allergies for those needing urgent care. Paramedics will be able to see full information on a patient they're blue lighting to hospital. The Department of Health says the risk of misdiagnosis will be reduced, meaning fewer patients going to A&E. But the doctors' union, the British Medical Association, said there were real concerns about security and confidentiality.
An investigation by BBC Panorama has found that midwives at an NHS trust in Nottingham wanted pregnant women to stay at home and wrote an offensive expression against the names of some of them. The programme has spoken to 10 former staff at the trust. An independent review into maternity care at the Nottingham University Hospital's NHS Trust, examining 2,500 cases, is due to be published later this month. Our social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan, reports.
The attitude of some maternity staff to women in early labour is revealed in a resignation letter from a midwife written in 2018. She said one midwife wrote FOH on a whiteboard beside some women's names, an offensive acronym showing they wanted the women to go home. Some former employees say the poor attitude stemmed from a lack of staff. The chief executive of the trust, who started after the maternity inquiry was announced, said the organisation had to take responsibility for its past failures and that he was focused on improving care now.
You can see Panorama, Maternity Failures, The Fight for Justice tonight at 8pm on BBC One and on iPlayer now. There's been disruption at Glasgow and Edinburgh airports because of problems with the supply of jet fuel. Posts on social media suggest some flights have been delayed, but this hasn't been confirmed by any airlines. A UK government source said the problem was linked to a driver and a logistics issue at one company. Here's our business correspondent, Jonathan Josephs.
The blockade of the Strait of Hormuz has restricted global supplies of the oil that is vital to making jet fuel. This has heightened concerns about shortages. However, none have yet materialised, and it doesn't appear to be the issue here. It seems one supplier is having some difficulty servicing airlines at Glasgow and Edinburgh airports. Both airports are served by several fuel companies, meaning alternatives should be available. British Airways and EasyJet both say they haven't experienced any problems. As ever, the best advice is to check with your airline before travelling.
A study led by American scientists has found that a daily pill can almost double the survival time of patients with advanced pancreatic cancer. Experts have described the drug as a game changer. Rory Gallimore reports.
Pancreatic cancer has the highest mortality rate of all major cancers. It's often spotted late and it's notoriously difficult to treat. So this pill, daraxonrasib, appears to be a breakthrough. The trial involved 500 people whose cancer had already spread to other organs. It found the median survival time for those who took the pill was just over a year, compared with about 6.5 months for those who had chemotherapy. The new drug also caused fewer side effects. The findings have been met with genuine optimism. One scientist at the University of Arizona, who's treated the disease for more than a decade, said when she read the results, she started to cry.
Rory Gallimore reporting.
Thank you for that. It is 6:07. Let us turn to the weather. It comes this morning from Simon King. Morning, Simon.
Hello, Justin. Good morning. Well, of course, last week we had the heat wave. But we start meteorological summer today and the weather has turned much more unsettled. Low pressure is going to be dominant throughout this week, but it will bring us some much needed rain to some parts. But for southwest England, southeast and eastern England, a bit of early sunshine actually across East Anglia and the southeast of England. A bit of fog though, with some murky conditions down to the southwest early on. Now, as we go through this morning, clouds are going to increase across all areas. We'll see a few showers for much of the day, but it's by this evening showers will become heavier and more widespread across all parts into the night. Temperatures getting to 17 to 23 degrees. For Wales, the Midlands, northwest and northeast England, it's a cloudy start. We've got some showery rain across northern England, and we're going to see some outbreaks of rain moving into Wales and spreading eastward into the Midlands by lunchtime. Some heavier rain and thunderstorms into Wales later this afternoon that will move their way eastward. It's going to be quite breezy with temperatures of 15 to 19 degrees. Now, for Northern Ireland today, it's a cloudy start. A few showers around, maybe a longer spell of rain or two for a time this morning. Sunny spells, though, develop later this afternoon. Highs of 18 or 19 degrees. Across Scotland, rain in southwest Scotland is going to spread north and eastward. And then during the afternoon, the rain will become cleared for most areas, but except the far northeast of Scotland, it will continue here. Still, though, quite cloudy with a few showers and temperatures of 15 to 17 Celsius.
Thank you very much indeed, Simon. 9 minutes past six now. Let's take a first look at the front pages of this morning's papers. The Guardian today leads on the release of government documents about Lord Mandelson, which it says contain no record of measures taken to mitigate security concerns about him becoming the ambassador to the US. It says the files lack detail on steps put in place to deal with concerns about his links to senior figures in foreign states. Peter Mandelson declined to comment.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is considering deals with the private sector to fund major building projects, according to the Daily Telegraph. The paper notes Ms Reeves risks a backlash from the left in her party over what it calls the Blair-style initiative. The Treasury tells the paper it's not going back to the old model, but it is considering ways private finance could support its infrastructure ambitions.
The Times says two of Labour's largest trade unions have warned that their members are now as likely to support Reform UK as they are to support Labour. Unite and the GMP say, GMB say their poll shows the working class have abandoned Sir Keir Starmer's party. A Labour source is quoted as saying the party is and always has been for working people.
The Daily Express says the development of a pill that almost doubles survival times for pancreatic cancer patients brings hope to millions. The paper calls the drug the biggest leap forward in the fight against the disease for decades. The Daily Mirror's headline reads "Precious gift of time" and quotes a cancer expert who says she cried after seeing how effective the pill was.
The Sun this morning leads on the surprise wedding of the pop star Dua Lipa and the actor Callum Turner in what it calls the celeb marriage of the year. Its front page features a picture of the two walking down the steps of a registrar office in London with the headline, "I, Dua."
And rock markings in Mumbles in South Wales, the authenticity of which were dismissed in 1928, have now been reclassified as the UK's oldest prehistoric cave paintings, according to The Guardian. It says scientists have used the latest methods to establish that the horizontal red bands were created more than 17,000 years ago.
It's 11 minutes past six now. Israeli forces have moved even more deeply into Lebanon, occupying land there and a totemic castle beyond the Litani River. That's the demarcation line that was set out in UN Resolution 1701. Our correspondent John Sudworth is in Beirut. And that in itself is notable, isn't it, John? How far Israeli forces are moving into Lebanon now?
Yeah, the taking of Beaufort Castle is being seen as a symbolic victory in Israel. It will give the Israeli troops inside Lebanon a commanding view of large swathes of the south of this country and all the way down into northern Israel, into the Galilee region, and will, Israel believes, be key to helping it stop the rockets and drones that are being fired across the border by Hezbollah. Those firings still continuing despite the invasion. And of course, that's the problem here, that Israel claims that this whole action is predicated on the idea of taking the fight to Hezbollah. And yet all the time, Hezbollah is able to withdraw and continue its military action. An intervention from the US Secretary of State in the last 24 hours, reports out of Washington, suggesting that he has spoken to both sides, the Lebanese government and the Israeli government. But the proposal there seems to be really an idea of the Lebanese government putting pressure on Hezbollah first. There was a time a few weeks ago when it looked as if Washington was pressuring Israel to rein in its military activity, particularly as it looked like that US-Iran deal was closer. The worry was that Lebanon and an escalation here could complicate that. As that US-Iran peace deal now seems to be further complicated, further away than perhaps was being reported a while ago, it now looks as if Israel might be given more room to pursue its military action and continue to push even further north.
And what impact does that have, John, on the Lebanese government's efforts to try and persuade Hezbollah to disarm?
Well, it's complicated. There's no doubt about it. Hezbollah, the support for Hezbollah is slipping. It was always located in terms of its deep strength in particular communities, in those Shia communities in the south, for example. But there is fatigue with its strategy, a feeling amongst the majority of Lebanese that its decision to fire rockets at Israel in support of Lebanon when the bombing of of Iran by the US and Israel began a few months ago was a giant strategic mistake that has dragged this country back into war. But on the other hand, of course, there's no love for Israel or its current action. The images we're getting every day of the intensive bombing of Lebanese towns and cities in the south, the continued occupation, expanding occupation of large parts of the south of this country, the displacement of tens of thousands of Lebanese, and the rising civilian casualty numbers is of course causing deep concern. And a statement over the weekend from the Lebanese Prime Minister Nawaf Salam suggesting that in his view it is Israel that is escalating this conflict, accusing Israel of pursuing a scorched earth policy. So very little sign of a breakthrough, but clearly from Israel now an intention to continue pushing this war. They feel that they are able to pursue the advantage. And at the moment, even with the taking of this high ground around Beaufort Castle, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was suggesting that this is an invasion that is only going to widen and deepen further.
John Sudworth in Beirut. Thank you.
6:15 is the time. Let us check in on the water situation in Kent. You will remember, and you'll certainly know if you live in Kent, that the taps started running dry for thousands of customers of South East Water on the 23rd of May. It is quite a few days after that, isn't it? Simon Joseph is our correspondent in Kent. And Simon, at least most of those for whom the water ran dry have now got it again. Is that right?
Yeah, it's day 10, though, of disruption. 14 areas of Kent are still affected, as well as Lewes in East Sussex. South East Water saying, yes, the majority of customers will now see their tap water back. But they're warning that more than 4,000 homes and businesses are experiencing low water pressure or an intermittent supply. And that means water may come and go during the day, particularly at peak times in the morning and evenings. The areas affected include Whitstable, Headcorn, Cranbrook, Coxheath and Luce. It's a real headache for businesses in particular. There's one on the outskirts of Whitstable. They had a wedding, a hotel that had a wedding over the course of the weekend. They didn't want to let the bride and groom down, so they were actually forced to bring in an outside firm that usually provides water for festivals to make sure the event could go ahead. And there was also a protest of residents and businesses at Whitstable. They took to the sea, donning bathing hats and sponges and toothbrushes to really show their best chance of having a wash was to head into the water.
Do we know whether businesses in particular are going to get compensation? Because it has, I mean, particularly for small businesses where tourists were about to come and just decided not to come. This is a life and death thing, isn't it?
Yeah, particularly areas like Whitstable, the seaside, where over the past week it was half term, the weather was beautiful, and many of the shops, hotels, restaurants simply had to shut because they couldn't open safely because they didn't have a water supply. Now, South East Water says they will get compensation. I think the issue we've had in the past, because we've had lots of outages in Kent in the past, is just calculating the amount of business loss. And there's often rows between the companies, the businesses and the water company about just how they put figures on it. In terms of residents, they're told they should get £50 per 12 hours that they've been without water. But the real problem is South East Water can't say when this will end. Obviously, it's cooler now, it's not so hot, and there will be less demand on supplies. But people just want to be able to turn their taps on and simply find water coming out of them.
Simon Jones in Kent, thank you.
It's 18 minutes past six. Donald Trump has appointed a tourism ambassador to encourage more visitors to the US from overseas, and they're visiting London today. Felicity Hannah is here with the latest on that and the rest of the morning's business news as well. Hello, Flis.
Morning, yes. So last week, the US National Travel and Tourism Office published visitor numbers showing that 4 million fewer people had visited the US in 2025 compared to the year before. There is, of course, going to be a boost for the World Cup over the coming weeks. But what does it say about tourism into the US right now? Let's ask Nick Adams, who is the Special Presidential Envoy for American Tourism, Exceptionalism and Values. Nick, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
That's quite a title, and it's quite a job, isn't it? 4 million visitors down on the previous year. What's going on?
It's true to say that demand fell last year, Felicity, but we are seeing a big rebound this year, and we're doing more to show what people are missing, to process people more quickly at the borders, to widen the very successful global entry program. All of the data that is coming across my desk is showing an uptick. 3% more flights, 1 million more seats, higher visitor numbers, 5% forecast higher spend.
Not all the data is showing that, is it? The Men's Football World Cup is less than 2 weeks away, and I was looking at a recent report from American Hotel and Lodging Association. It represents more than 32,000 properties, 80% of franchised hotels. It said that bookings are well below expectations in almost every host city.
Felicity, the data that I'm seeing doesn't suggest that, whether it's the Cirium data, the World Travel and Tourism Council forecast, airline demand, hotel overnights, the latest data shows that everything is on the up. We are very excited. As you know, it's very typical as well that before these kind of mega events, people wait for the last minute to buy their tickets and organize their travel. But what we're seeing, every indication, this is going to be a hugely successful World Cup and a hugely successful travel and tourism era for the United States.
And when you talk about an era, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because people have been hearing stories here in the UK that they will have to turn over access to their social media accounts. There have been reports in the press here of ICE agents arresting tourists. Would you agree that that's putting some people off?
Well, I welcome the question. I can tell you that some people may have been put off by talk of social media being checked for the last 5 years, but that plan has not been implemented. And if you apply for an ESTA visa in good time, then 99.9% of people will smoothly enter the USA without any issues at all. One of the reasons that I got this role was to be able to counter a lot of the perceptions that misperceptions, that have developed. And I want to make sure that everybody listening knows, Felicity, that if you come to the United States of America, you will find it to be a safe place. You will not find it to be an expensive place. Your visit will be seamless from the moment
but
that you land
you're
on the
having
tarmac.
To, you're having to make that case for a country where previously plenty of people wouldn't have occurred to them that it wouldn't be safe. And I was just also curious because last July, the US Congress voted in favor of reducing federal match funding to Brand USA. That's the organization that promotes international tourism to the US, reduced it from $100 million to $20 million. Is it possible that was sending a signal that it just didn't care much if outsiders came in?
No, the creation of my role. It's the first time ever that the United States has had representation on the White House or presidential level for travel and tourism. I can tell you that I work every day with Brand USA. They are still very active. They do great things. They're a very valuable partner. And I have to make the case because unfortunately, a lot of the media have been building this narrative that America is inhospitable, that it's unwelcoming, and that's just simply not the case. And I would urge anybody who wants to know what visiting the United States as a tourist is like, Felicity, to ask their neighbours, to ask their friends, to ask their business colleagues, their work colleagues who have recently been.
I want to ask you about some of the discussion of the UK in America. Donald Trump has been quite a critic of London and its mayor, saying there are no-go areas in the capital. There has been quite a lot of misinformation and disinformation about London shared in the US. Can I ask, on your visit, what your impression of London has been so far?
Well, I can tell you that 4 million British people visited the USA last year. It's the third biggest visitor market. And we know that the British will continue to put the USA on their bucket list for travel.
I'm asking for your impression of London.
Well, yes, I like London. I've been here many times. I'm here again. But let me just finish my point.
I think you've made that point. And what I want to understand is whether you think comments about London, for example, like that from Donald Trump, sort of shapes how people in the UK view their relationship with the US and view their potential tourism with the US.
Trump has appointed me, Felicity, to showcase why America is such a great place to visit. We have 50 states, which in effect are 50 countries for people to visit. We have everything. We're entering a golden age of sports and events in the USA. I want to welcome everybody in London, everybody all across the United Kingdom and indeed the world to come and visit us, come and make lifetime memories as you visit the United States, meet our incredible people, see our unmatched landscapes. And you'll be remembering the trip for the rest of your life.
And comments like that don't make your job harder.
I'm here to promote tourism and travel felicity. I will do it under any circumstance. I'm very happy to do it, particularly here in the United Kingdom, where we have a special relationship. And the British people love coming to America and vice versa.
Okay.
British hotels need American guests and we need you guys as well.
Nick Adams, Special Presidential Envoy for American Tourism, Exceptionalism and Values. Thank you very much indeed.
Felicity, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Now, private electric vehicle ownership in the UK has jumped by almost 46% in a year. That's according to new analysis by the AA. April LaRoos is Head of Investment Specialists at Insight Investment. Joins me now. April, good morning.
Good morning.
So the number of privately owned EVs on UK roads rose from just over 533,000 at the end of 2024 to more than 777,000 by the end of last year. These numbers don't reflect the number of people who might make the switch since the Iran war pushed up prices at the pump, but it does suggest a significant shift.
Yes, it does. I think it shows that initially when EVs came out, they were quite expensive. And frankly, they were considered a bit of a premium product, but they've really gone much more mainstream. Lots more cars available. You can buy a used EV at much more affordable prices. And of course, the manufacturers are still offering some pretty decent discounts, which is enticing people to dive in and buy those cars.
I suppose the question for British manufacturing in particular is, where are these vehicles coming from?
Well, all different manufacturers, but actually what we've seen notably is that Chinese EVs are making a real push into the UK. One out of every 10 new cars is a Chinese vehicle manufactured. So that is making a big difference because, of course, they're coming in at a very, very attractive price.
The front page of the FT this morning is suggesting that Wall Street bulls are betting the US stocks rally has further to go. Investors very much putting their faith in AI. We did see an incredible May for the S&P 500, didn't we? Record closing highs on half of all trading days. Some people are worried about the AI sort of boom overheating the market, but this suggests investors are really upbeat.
Yes, and it's just a continued story. The S&P so far is up 11% this year to date. So this story continues to rumble on in the face of high energy costs and a continued war in the Middle East. So it is quite astonishing how this investment trend has really captured the imagination.
April LaRoos from Insight Investment, thank you very much indeed. Now, heavyweights from the business, technology and creative industries are descending on London today for the South by Southwest Festival. Really, really big names. Michelle Obama, the Reddit founder, Ben & Jerry's co-founder Ben Cohen, among those taking to the stage. And this is the second time it's been staged in London after being held in Austin, Texas for almost 40 years. Joining them will be Ben Drury, CEO of Yoto, which is a company that makes screen-free interactive audio players designed for children. Ben, good morning.
Good morning, Fiz.
It's a star-studded event, and you've actually got a pretty star-studded list of investors yourself, including Mark Zuckerberg and Sir Paul McCartney. What do you expect that the technology bosses in particular will be keen to talk about at this year's festival?
Well, one thing that's great about South by Southwest London is it does film that bridge between the US and the UK. And I think the UK can really show its strengths at South by Southwest London with incredible creative industries, incredible fashion, and obviously sports. Arsenal were celebrating their Premier League win where I live last night. And now we're going to see the World Cup in the US.
I like how you managed to shoehorn that in. You recently visited LA as part of a UK-US trade mission. What's your impression? We were just talking about the state of UK-US tourism. What's your impression of UK-US trade at the moment?
Well, I think there's definitely been some headwinds. There's been some rocky shores, but things are definitely improving. And going out to LA with the likes of Gareth Southgate was an incredible trip. And we were spending time in LA, which is obviously the heart of the US creative industries. And yeah, a real sense of optimism. There's lots of fantastic deals being done between the two countries. And obviously AI was dominating a lot of talk, but the UK is actually playing, punching above its weight in AI as well, with Google DeepMind being based here in King's Cross.
The US is actually your biggest market, isn't it, for your audio player devices. What about the new tariff regime? What's that meant for your business?
We launched in the US in June 2020, right in the middle of COVID, when we couldn't even travel there and we didn't even have anyone on the ground. But it's really been an incredible market for us across all those 50 states that your previous guest was talking about. Tariffs were dominating us last year. You know, there was a kind of mini tariff war that was going on, but it's all settled down and we're actually getting refunds now from the US government.
Well, I'm sure that helps. I hope you have a good day at the festival. Ben Drury, CEO of Yotto, thank you very much indeed.
Yes, thank you. 29 minutes past six. To the sport, here is Cathy.
Thank you. Good morning. It's been a very big cup weekend across several sports. We'll start with Manchester City women, who have won the domestic double, adding the FA Cup to their Women's Super League title. City beat Brighton 4-0 at Wembley, with WSL Player of the Season Khadija Shaw scoring their opening goal.
Long season, so to get the double, it's a good feeling. I've always said that Manchester is home, and it took a while, but we finally got it done, and yeah, we just have to keep going and see what's to come.
Celtic won the Scottish Cup for the third time with a 1-0 win over Rangers women. Liverpool will open formal talks with Andoni Iraola this week over becoming their new head coach after sacking Arne Slot on Saturday, just a year after he had guided Liverpool to the Premier League title. Arsenal's men's team lost the Champions League on penalties to Paris Saint-Germain on Saturday, but yesterday hundreds of thousands of supporters took to the streets of North London to celebrate with the club as Arsenal showed off their first Premier League trophy in 22 years, as well as celebrating winning the Women's Champions Cup during an open-top bus parade. We'll be speaking to Arsenal's CEO, Richard Garlick, later in the programme. And as teams start to head to the World Cup, 19-year-old Tyler Fletcher has been called up to Scotland's World Cup squad as a replacement for the injured Billy Gilmour. At tennis's French Open, the teenager, Joao Fonseca, backed up his big win over Novak Djokovic by defeating the former two-time French Open finalist Casper Ruud to reach the quarterfinals of a Grand Slam for the first time.
It was more like a battle of who's more aggressive in the beginning and who's committing more to points. And yeah, I think in the beginning I was putting a lot of pressure on him, and especially on the important points, I played really well. But yeah, I think it was different matches, but today I played a little bit more solid to the whole match.
The second seed, Alexander Zverev, will play the Spanish 19-year-old Rafael Hodar in the last eight, but the four-time Roland Garros champion Iga Świątek has been knocked out of the tournament by the 15th seed Marta Kostyuk as the surprise results keep coming in Paris. In rugby union's Prem, Exeter Chiefs beat Leicester Tigers 35 points to 26 to move into the playoff places, while Wigan Warriors men and women's teams won Rugby League's Challenge Cup titles. Cycling, and Jonas Vingegaard has won the overall pink jersey at the Giro d'Italia to become only the eighth rider in history to win all three men's cycling grand tours, following wins in the Tour de France and Vuelta a España. Matt Warwick has the details.
Vingegaard's dominant victory in the Roman Evening Sun felt predictable. In the Alps and the Dolomites, he was imperious, evidenced by the sheer pain etched on the faces of his domestiques. But the true entertainment across 3 weeks came from lesser riders who took more risks. Igor Arrieta and Afonso Eulalio's epic duel into Potenza had it all. Crashes, diversions and streams of rainwater before Spaniard Arrieta crossed the line in tears, with blood running down his arms. Just another day on another frantic Giro d'Italia.
And Alyssa Balsamo won stage two of the women's Giro d'Italia race with a perfectly timed sprint finish.
Thank you, Cathy. 28 minutes to seven now. Next Sunday on Radio 4, we'll hear tales of young adventures and childhood memories in the works of a celebrated Welsh writer.
I do miss the bruised young man I used to be.
Short stories from the childhood of Dylan Thomas.
I so badly wanted to see my name in print, yet everything I'd written embarrassed me.
Geraint Howell stars in a beloved collection of Thomas's works.
Jump in, Mr. Thomas!
Sorry, boys. I'm afraid I've got work on.
As if you do.
You've never worked a day in your life!
Portrait of the Artist as a Young Dog by Dylan Thomas.
A young man who could well be the greatest poet of his generation.
Next Sunday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4, Anna Foster, Justin Webb and Caroline Nichols with the news.
More than 1,000 pages of documents related to Lord Mandelson's time as ambassador to the US are due to be released later today. They're expected to include text messages between ministers and the disgraced Labour peer who was sacked due to his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Kuwait's military says its air defences have been intercepting missile and drone attacks. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps has said that it targeted a US airbase in response to an attack over the weekend on Sirik Island in the south of the country. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has spoken to the leaders of both Israel and Lebanon to try to de-escalate the conflict with Hezbollah. Israeli troops are pushing further north, seizing the 900-year-old Beaufort Castle. According to a US official, Mr. Rubio has proposed that as a first step, Lebanese officials should put pressure on Hezbollah to stop cross-border attacks, and in return, Israel would refrain from further escalation. France has detained a sanctioned Russian oil tanker in the Atlantic with support from British forces. President Emmanuel Macron said it was unacceptable for ships to circumvent international sanctions and fund Russia's war against Ukraine. Plans for a single patient record for the NHS in England will be debated for the first time by MPs today. The aim is to combine GP, hospital and social care data so people don't have to keep repeating their story at appointments and doctors can quickly get access to patient information. An investigation by BBC Panorama has found that midwives at an NHS trust in Nottingham wanted pregnant women to stay at home and wrote an offensive expression against the names of some of them. The programme has spoken to 10 former staff at the trust. An independent review into maternity care at the Nottingham University Hospital's NHS Trust, examining 2,500 cases, is due to be published later this month.
Thank you for that. It is 7:25 and it is Peter Mandelson Day, as we were hearing in the news. Another tranche of documents from the government is going to be published today, or at least given to the relevant MPs, and we will get to see all of them. And when I say Henry Zaffman, our chief political correspondent, all of them, it is quite a sizable amount, isn't it, that we're expecting?
Staggeringly broad, Justin, and I think that is worth just reminding ourselves. I mean, I'm told that the publication today is so big that when printed out and bound, which it will be, is going to be made up of three volumes. There are over 160 pages of Peter Mandelson's WhatsApps and text messages alone. And we're calling it a tranche, but actually, save for a few documents which the Metropolitan Police has asked the government to hold back because they are conducting a criminal investigation into Peter Mandelson, who denies wrongdoing, save for those documents, this is it. So just as a reminder of what Parliament voted for back in February and what we're going to get today, papers relating to Lord Mandelson's appointment and the vetting process, we saw some of that back in March. But then additionally, all texts and WhatsApps between Morgan McSweeney, the Prime Minister's former chief of staff, and Peter Mandelson in the 6 months prior to his appointment, all texts and WhatsApps and minutes of meetings between any government minister and Peter Mandelson in the 6 months prior to his appointment, and then all texts, WhatsApps, emails, and minutes of every meeting Lord Mandelson had with any government minister, any government official, and any special advisor during his entire period of time as ambassador. So little wonder, Justin, that this is being described by the government as one of the biggest publications of documents they have laid before Parliament ever.
And I think you've sort of hinted at the answer to this, but The Guardian on its front page in an exclusive saying Mandelson files show no mitigation of security concerns over top US job. And this is the idea that we heard plenty about, didn't we, that there were going to be mitigations put into place in order that those worries that people had about him doing the job could be assuaged. But you say that the police have kept some files back, and presumably it's possible, I guess we don't know, but it's possible that these are those.
Possibly so. I mean, speaking to people in government in advance of this publication, I think mostly they're not necessarily concerned that this document release will provide new impetus to the question of why Sir Keir Starmer appointed Lord Mandelson as ambassador and what he did and didn't know, something that the Prime Minister now believes was one of his gravest errors in office. But what they are braced for is, via Lord Mandelson almost, a window being opened into how parts of this government have operated, into how senior government figures interact with each other, and perhaps even into what some senior government ministers truly think, or at least have said, about Sir Keir Starmer in messages which they would never have anticipated would have ended up being published. And I think it's there that some of the greatest potential for embarrassment, to say the very least, lurks later today.
Henry Zaffman, thank you.
It's 22 minutes to 7. US warplanes have hit fresh targets in Iran in the last few hours. Iranian drones have also been fired towards Kuwait. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell can tell us more. Yolande, there's supposed to be a ceasefire in place, but it's not the first time this has happened during that. What do we know?
So we don't have full details, but, you know, 3 months into this ceasefire, this is just the latest in a series of military exchanges that there have been between the US and Iran. The US saying that it struck Iranian military sites on Saturday and yesterday, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard saying it struck a US airbase in response. And sure enough, once again, the US ally Kuwait reporting sirens going off across the country, interceptions of missiles and drones this morning without giving more details. It's a very similar pattern to what happened just last Thursday. And now US Central Command put out a short statement. It said the strikes it carried out on Iran's Gulf coast were in response to what it called aggressive Iranian actions that included the shooting down of a US drone operating over international waters. It said that it had eliminated Iranian air defences, a ground control station, two attack drones, which it said posed clear threats to shipping. And the US is, you know, consistently presenting these actions as self-defense. But the fear really remains that one of these exchanges could spiral into a more serious escalation, and that could really undermine any ongoing efforts to get this ceasefire deal.
Yes, and on that point, Yolande, it is really quite tricky to work out the facts of where that situation is, because we're reliant on what the US say, what the Iranians say, and things can change by the hour.
Definitely. And it's very difficult to keep track of it. And US sources have been kind of quoted in the media saying that the two sides are close to agreeing this memorandum of understanding. There are reports that a new draft text has gone from Washington back to the Iranians, that this proposed deal is supposed to kind of involve unrestricted shipping through the Strait of Hormuz without tolls, without impediments, Iran removing mines within 30 days, the US lifting its naval blockade in response to all of that, in response to commercial shipping coming back. But the Tasnim news agency in Iran has been stressing that, you know, the text is not finalised, saying that any announcement will come from Pakistan if a deal is done, really stressing that announcement must come from both Iran and from the Americans. And, you know, we watch and wait.
We do. We continue to, don't we? Thank you, Yolande Nell.
19 minutes to 7. It's a big day for the health service in England. A bill establishing a single patient record debated in the Commons, and at the same time, of course, more strikes in the offing. And the new health secretary telling us his priorities for the first time when we talked to him at 10 past 8. Let's talk now to Hugh Pimmer, health editor. Tell us about the bill that comes before the Commons first, Hugh.
Well, Justin, it's a really big piece of legislation. And as someone put to me the other day, any large bill about the NHS will get a lot of opinions from MPs and in committee as it goes forward. And it may take many, many months. Now, one of the most eye-catching bits of it is this single patient record for England, which brings together hospital, GP and social care data. And it addresses frustrations often voiced by A&E doctors that someone comes in and they really want to find out that patient's details of the GP record and they can't get hold of it. A surgeon said that a kidney transplant operation had to be postponed because he couldn't get hold of GP data just to check a patient's history over a weekend. Paramedics with a seriously ill patient can quickly get into a single patient record, and that will help them. So this idea of bringing it all together will help all these clinicians, and also be something available to patients that they'll be able to get hold of all their records on an NHS app. Now, there's been a welcome for that from various bits of the health world, but the BMA, the doctors' union, are saying that they do have serious concerns about confidentiality and security, that they've been the guardians of data since the foundation of the NHS, and there need to be real reassurances that the data won't be used inappropriately.
And there are also concerns, aren't there? In fact, we're about to hear them in 10 minutes or so, Hugh, from some unions, and indeed some others as well, about the choice of company that will be involved potentially in doing this.
That's right. Now, the name Palantir often comes up, the big American corporation, which has a deal with the NHS in England on the so-called Federated Data Platform. That is allowing doctors and other clinicians within hospitals to share data. Now, government sources say that this new arrangement, the single patient record, will have nothing to do with Palantir and that other programme, that it just simply is not the same thing at all. But yes, I'm sure MPs will be asking a lot of questions as the NHS Modernisation Bill progresses through Parliament on precisely who will get this contract, whether NHS IT can be improved after failings in previous times, and whether this really can be taken forward, the single patient record, in a way that benefits everybody. Be they doctors, nurses, other clinicians and patients.
Hugh Pym, thank you.
It is 16 minutes to seven now.
The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is a calamity, of course, for individuals, but also a crisis for the nation and potentially for the wider world, with news of suspected cases in Brazil this morning. But what is being done in the places from where it has all been spreading? The head of the WHO, Dr. Tedros, has been himself to see them and was joined on his journey by Emery Mukomeno, who is a BBC reporter. We've talked to him before about these matters, who's actually been around the country with Dr. Tedros and joins us now from Kinshasa. Emery, tell us what you and what he saw.
Good morning, Justin. Yeah, in Bunia, where we landed at the airport, you are directly you are directed to these water stations to clean your hands with water and soap, and then you see that there is Bunia has become really a hub for this Ebola response, with various UN agencies bringing in a lot of kit and equipment to deal with this. But when you go into the city, there's a sense of normality. Schools are open, markets are open, and people are just going about their daily activities. The motor riders are taking passengers, so you don't really see that there's an Ebola circulating in Bunia. But we know after talking to officials and the governor and other aid agencies that they are racing against time to contain the Ebola that has been circulating for more than a month.
Yeah. I remember when we talked about this before, Emery, you saying one of the big challenges is that people, naturally enough, want to touch the bodies of their loved ones who have died and want to be involved in the funeral process, etc., etc. And yet, of course, the doctor's saying, well, that is what spreads it. Have they made any progress? When you looked at these places and met these people, have they made progress in persuading people not to do those things that they might naturally want to do?
Well, a lot of Dr. Tedros' visit was concentrated on community ownership of this outbreak. Of course, people know that the disease can spread quickly with the contact with, especially with the third person, and they shouldn't touch. But this is not something that is automatic. Here in the DRC, you have the wake that take a whole night with family members doing rituals, and that's seen as the proper way to do a send-off. So if you put the body of their loved one in a bag, and then they can't do any ritual, so that's a difficult thing to ask to the community. But they are being, I mean, a lot of effort, a lot of community engagement is happening, and even Dr. Tedros met with some other community leaders there to explain that, of course, this is the practice, but because of this Ebola, people have to accept safe burials only done by health workers, but family members are even invited sometimes to see at least how the burial is taking place.
Emery Mukomeno, a BBC reporter covering that visit from Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thank you.
It's 13 minutes to 7. AI is the subject for our latest Today debate. Tomorrow we will be asking, is there a crisis of control in AI? You'll be able to listen, as always, here on Radio 4 or on BBC Sounds after the news at 8 o'clock tomorrow evening. On that topic, you might have noticed the Sunday Times reported yesterday that a student's graduate job offer was apparently withdrawn because the company involved was pushing towards artificial intelligence. James Reid is with us, the CEO of the recruitment specialists Reid. Good morning.
Hello, Anna. Good morning.
We don't know too much about the wider detail of that, whether it was specifically to do with this job, but I mean, it raises questions about the graduate jobs market in particular and the impact that you see that AI is having on that.
Well, I saw the story that you mentioned, and at face value, the young man who was affected was a very strong candidate. And it was surprising to read that he'd suddenly been told that there was no opportunity open for him. So, I mean, this graduate job squeeze is no longer theoretical. You know, it's happening now. It's real. We at Reed have repeatedly warned that AI is already reducing entry-level hiring. And this is especially true for office-based and admin roles. So I think young people more and more are not competing with other people for jobs, but with automation. I mean, I've often thought that a job is a problem to be solved. And if a job is a problem to be solved, more and more companies are asking, do we solve this problem with a person or with a robot? Whether that's sort of driverless cabs coming out of San Francisco or robots waiting table coming out of Tokyo. So there's a real disruption, and it's just the beginning. These stories are just the beginning, I believe, and there's a real disruption in the labour market. Big concern is, these entry-level jobs have historically been how people learned, and the risk is not simply fewer jobs but fewer opportunities to gain the experience that leads to better jobs. So it's a big issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. You know, those first jobs where you learn your trade are important, aren't they? I wonder how much of it we know that we can put down to something like AI, and how much is down to, because we hear regularly from employers on the programme who talk about the rising costs of employment, all of these different factors. So how much of it can we put down to AI?
Well, I think business leaders are becoming more explicit about it. I mean, when the Standard Chartered chief last week, Bill Winters spoke recently quite openly about replacing lower value human capital with AI to replace, I think it was 7,800 people. There was rightly, I think, an outcry. But what was some less reported was that the share price of his bank went up 2.5% that day. So businesses, I think, are actively looking at AI, and the pressure on costs, national insurance is one, has made them look closely, because, you know, AI is being sold, you know, in the marketplace as a way of reducing costs. And, you know, the companies that are promoting the new technologies often say this is a way to make your business more efficient or more productive, code for reducing headcount.
So what do you say then, James, to, you know, graduates, new graduates, and it's the time of the year for them now, who are coming across your threshold, they want jobs, and obviously you're dealing with industry as well. Rather than us all just throwing our hands up in the air and saying there's nothing to be done about it, what kind of advice do you give them as to how to sort of future-proof themselves against the rise of AI?
Well, the first thing to say is there are fewer graduate vacancies. I mean, we've seen that on our own website on Reed. You know, the number of graduate vacancies has fallen from 180,000 4 years ago to 50,000 last year. So don't be disappointed if you don't get the first or even 50th job that you apply for. It is a very competitive space. Having said that, you know, there are lots of opportunities still. There are over 100,000 jobs on our site today. It's important, though, I think, for young people to seek to add to their skills. And, you know, there are lots of places where you can go and learn new skills. You can even go and learn about AI at places like Anthropic's Academy, which will position you well for the labor market in the future. So I think make absolute maximum use of the tools available to learn more skills. And then there are certain areas that are actively hiring that are less affected by AI. Education and training is one. Health and care is another. Skilled trades, I'd recommend people looking at that, because there are lots of opportunities and apprenticeships in skilled trades, and people do well in those jobs and enjoy them.
Okay. James Reed, thanks for joining us.
It is 7:08. There is to be, as we were hearing just a few minutes ago, a new data system in the NHS in England. But there is controversy as well about who should run it, because Palantir, the US company, is in the running to do it and has previously provided data systems for the NHS. But there are those who don't want Palantir to be involved. Helga Pyle is on the line, head of health at the Union Unison. Morning to you.
Good morning.
So just before we get to Palantir, you are not objecting, are you, to the idea that we have this single record. And it's going to be something that comes in phases, isn't it? But we were just talking to Hugh Pym earlier on about it. And it sounds like most doctors, in spite of the misgivings of some in the BMA, most doctors, certainly in hospitals, think it's a good thing.
Well, I think the concept of a single patient record is something that all staff working in the NHS can see the benefit of, because there are real kind of delays, frustrations and risks caused by not being able to access full information about the patient you're seeing. So I think it will deliver real benefits, but it's really important that it's done in the right way. And so that matters about who is involved and how it's done. And we know that patients and staff are really, really concerned about the sensitivity of patient data, who can see it, but they also are really, really acutely aware of how lucrative it is for companies to get hold of that data and to make money out of it. So I think there needs to be lessons learned, and the real concerns that are being caused by Palantir's involvement in the NHS data landscape sort of show the problems that could arise if we don't maintain that trust and confidence.
But what do those concerns actually come from? Because Palantir themselves say they've put on loads of new operations or allowed them to happen because of the work they've already done. 110,000 additional operations, 15% reduction in discharge delays, 6.88 increase in the number of people finding out whether or not they have cancer within 28 days of referral. I mean, they do good, don't they, inside the health service? Or is that a misunderstanding, would you say, of their role?
I think there are mixed reports on the progress, but I think the bigger issue is that there is a real concern about the ethical standards of companies such as that are whose main business is surveillance, military involvement. The values of the NHS are held very dear by the public and by staff.
But surely their health is also held dear. I mean, if Palantir can successfully persuade people that they have improved health outcomes, then the wider interests of the company, will they really, should they be at the top of patients' minds?
I think you can see the level of concern that this has caused, and there's a really active debate about whether that contract should continue. So I think lessons need to be learned for this, because if this fails on the basis that patients don't want to consent to sharing their data, we will be back in a place that we've been in the past. So I think the way this is handled needs to have a number of things in it. There need to be ethical safeguards so that the people involved are consistent with NHS values, for public benefit as the primary motivation and not private profit. There need to be some really good data security safeguards. Again, we've seen recently real concern over massive leaks of data. And then I think really importantly, there needs to be full staff involvement from across the different disciplines and professional expertise that exists within the NHS, involvement in the design and the delivery of this system. That's really important.
Right. We're going to talk later on in the programme to James Murray, the new Health Secretary for England. Are you saying to him, rule out Palantir from this system? Do it now.
That would really give a lot of confidence at this stage. And I think what we need to see then is those reassurances about how this will be done, who will be involved, and that crucial involvement of staff in
but,
the design.
But not Palantir, you're saying?
I think if there are any lessons to be learned from the current concerns, then ruling out Palantir at this stage would give real confidence that there are going to be a different way of delivering this.
OK, well, we'll put that to him. Helga Pyle, Head of Health at Unison. Thank you.
Things just swirling around my head. Am I really the product of this?
Astonishing secrets uncovered by at-home DNA tests.
Little did I know what more was to come.
I'm Jenny Kleeman, and in the new series of The Gift, we'll hear more stories emerging out of the ever-expanding global DNA database.
I did know that I was different.
You had kids together.
Yeah.
Then we met.
Then we met.
The Gift. Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's time to check the weather at 2 minutes to 7. Simon Kingsley, morning.
Good morning, Anna. Temperatures have dropped significantly from last weekend. Now we're into the first day of meteorological summer, so a real different feel to the weather throughout this week with some rain in the forecast. But it is going to be much needed rain, actually, for some of us. It's been exceptionally dry this spring so far for East Anglia and the southeast of England. It could be, for some locations, in the top three driest springs on record, actually. So, yes, welcome rain in the forecast. But for southern England and eastern England, a bit of brightness this morning, actually, around East Anglia and the southeast of England. More cloud the further south and west you go. Some murky conditions here. Cloud spreads to all areas as we go through this morning. And we'll see a few showers likely for much of the day, but it's by this evening where we'll see some heavy, perhaps thundery showers become more widespread across southern and eastern areas of England, and that will continue into the night. Temperatures 17 to 23 degrees. For Wales, the Midlands and across northern England, pretty cloudy to start off with, some shower or rain, especially across northern areas of England. We'll see some heavier bursts of rain spreading into Wales and move eastwards into the Midlands by lunchtime, and then by this evening, further heavy and thundery showers spread through Wales later on. Quite breezy, temperatures 15 to 19 degrees. For Northern Ireland, cloudy with a few showers, some longer spells of rain at times, perhaps through this morning, sunnier spells developing later, highs of 18 or 19. And across Scotland, rain in southwestern areas of Scotland this morning, moving away to the northeast. And during this afternoon, the rain would have cleared from most areas except the northeast of Scotland. Still quite cloudy, quite showery though, into the afternoon. And maximum temperatures today getting to about 15 to 17 Celsius.
Simon, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 1st of June. The headlines today: the government is braced for further embarrassment from the release later of hundreds more official documents relating to Lord Mandelson's time as US ambassador. America and Iran have launched fresh attacks on each other's military bases in the Gulf, where Kuwait says it's intercepting missile and drone attacks. And MPs will today debate plans for a single patient record for the NHS in England, combining information from GPs, hospitals and social care. We will speak to the new Health Secretary about it at 8:10.
Plus, coming up in the next hour, why did a former Facebook executive take to the stage at the Hay Festival for a whole hour without saying a single thing? But before that, a moment of calm. That is quite enough calm for the moment. We'll be hearing, though, about the ghostly ancient forests that nature lovers want to bring back to life. The BBC News read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
More than 1,000 pages of documents related to Lord Mandelson's time as ambassador to the US are due to be released later today. They're expected to include text messages between ministers and the disgraced Labour peer. Senior government figures and civil servants lost their jobs over the appointment of Lord Mandelson, who was given security clearance despite concerns raised by vetting officials. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
The release of some of the Epstein files in the US revealed the extent of Lord Mandelson's friendship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein and led to his sacking. This tranche of documents, amongst the largest ever laid in Parliament, will give us details of the discussions around the peer's appointment, as well as an insight into his time as the UK's man in Washington. It will contain emails, briefings and memos, as well as pages of messages on what seems to be the government's preferred communications platform, WhatsApp. Senior government sources have conceded the tranche will include details of exchanges which are, in their words, embarrassing and cringeworthy. Lord Mandelson's vetting file will not be included. It's understood the Met Police have asked for it to be held back while they investigate him on suspicion of misconduct in a public office. He has denied wrongdoing. Other disclosures will be redacted on grounds of national security or international relations, such as private messages which could be critical of President Trump.
Kuwait's military says its air defences have been intercepting missile and drone attacks. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps has said that it targeted a US airbase in response to an attack on Sirik Island in the south of the country. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
This is the third known military escalation between the US and Iran in the space of a week. Kuwaiti state media reported that sirens were sounding across the country this morning. US Central Command then stated that it had carried out what it described as self-defense strikes at two Iranian drone command and control sites over the weekend. It said this was in response to what it called aggressive Iranian actions, including shooting down a US drone over international waters. The latest developments underline the fragility of the ceasefire between the US and Iran, as negotiators on both sides have appeared to edge towards a deal to extend it.
President Trump has repeated his claim that Iran wants to make a deal, which would be a good one for the US and its allies. But in a social media post this morning, he said his political opponents were making it much harder for him to do his job and negotiate. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has spoken to Israeli and Lebanese leaders as the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah continues to escalate. France and Germany have both criticised Israel's push further into southern Lebanon. From Beirut, here's our correspondent John Sudworth.
With the ceasefire announced in April now in tatters, Israeli troops are pushing further north, crossing the Litani River to seize the 900-year-old Beaufort Castle that sits on top of a strategically important ridge. But their invasion has not yet stopped Hezbollah, the militant group based in Lebanon, from firing barrages of missiles and drones across the border. According to a US official, the Secretary of State Marco Rubio has spoken to both sides, proposing that, as a first step, Lebanese officials should pressure Hezbollah to stop its attacks, and in return, that would create space for Israel to limit its military action, particularly in Beirut. But over the weekend, the Lebanese Prime Minister Nawaf Salam suggested it was Israel that was escalating the conflict, accusing it of pursuing a scorched earth policy.
France says it's detained a sanctioned Russian oil tanker in the Atlantic with the help of Britain and other allies. The Tagore was intercepted yesterday morning in international waters. President Macron said it was unacceptable for ships to circumvent international sanctions and fund Russia's war against Ukraine. Plans for a single patient record for the NHS in England will be debated for the first time by MPs today. The aim is to combine GP, hospital and social care data so people don't have to keep repeating their story at appointments and doctors can quickly access patient information. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
A&E doctors are frustrated that they sometimes can't get access to patients' GP records. Under this plan, they'll quickly be able to check complete histories, medication and allergies for those needing urgent care. Paramedics will be able to see full information on a patient they're blue lighting to hospital. In some parts of England, there's already limited shared data, but the aim is to ensure consistency across the whole system. The Department of Health says the risk of misdiagnosis will be reduced, meaning fewer patients going to A&E, and GPs will save time because they'll obtain full patient histories more quickly. But the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, said there were real concerns about security and confidentiality, and there'd have to be assurances that patient data would not be used inappropriately.
An investigation by BBC Panorama has found that midwives at an NHS trust in Nottingham wanted pregnant women to stay at home and wrote an offensive expression against the names of some of them. The programme has spoken to 10 former staff at the trust. An independent review into maternity care at the Nottingham University Hospital's NHS Trust, examining 2,500 cases, is due to be published later this month. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
The attitude of some maternity staff to women in early labour is revealed in a resignation letter from a midwife written in 2018. She said one midwife encouraged colleagues to tell a pregnant woman to leave hospital and don't be too kind, she'll keep coming back, while another wrote FOH on a whiteboard beside some women's names, an offensive acronym showing they wanted the women to go home. The failure of staff to recognise that women in early labour needed medical attention was a repeated problem at the Nottingham Trust, leading to avoidable harm. Some former employees say the poor attitude stemmed from a lack of staff. At one point, the Trust didn't know it needed dozens more midwives due to miscalculating its staffing level. The chief executive of the Trust, who started after the maternity inquiry was announced, said the organisation had to take responsibility for its past failures and that he was focused on improving care now.
You can see Panorama, Maternity Failures, The Fight for Justice tonight at 8 o'clock on BBC One and on iPlayer Now. There's been disruption at Glasgow and Edinburgh airports because of problems with the supply of jet fuel. Posts on social media suggest some flights have been delayed, but this hasn't been confirmed by any airlines. A UK government source said the problem was linked to a driver and a logistics issue at one company. British Airways and EasyJet say their flights are unaffected. Health officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo have welcomed the recovery of five patients infected with a rare type of Ebola virus, which has no approved vaccine or treatment. They say it highlights progress in the response to the outbreak caused by the Bundibugyo strain, which has killed more than 240 people. Our Global Affairs reporter, Richard Kagoye, reports from Nairobi.
The patients, four nurses, walked out of a treatment centre in Bunia yesterday. They had fallen ill while caring for Ebola patients and said that they were grateful to be alive. Another survivor, Alabwaka, went home on Friday. Dr. Mwamba Kazadi, the director of the Institute of Public Health, calls the recoveries a victory worth celebrating. He says early detection and strong care made the difference. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, was visiting Ituri province, the center of the outbreak, has said trust is key. He's urged communities to work with medical staff after some residents attacked health centers over strict burial rules that clash with local traditions.
A study led by American scientists has found that a daily pill can almost double the survival time of patients with advanced pancreatic cancer. The trial involved 500 people whose cancer had already spread to other organs. It found the median survival time for those who took the drug, called Daxanrabsib, was just over a year, compared with about 6.5 months for those who had chemotherapy.
Thank you for that. 7:09 is the time. Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, will be back in the news today as the government releases that tranche of documents related to his appointment as ambassador to the United States. But going much wider, it seems, than that as well. The Guardian is reporting an interesting omission, though, this morning. No record of efforts to mitigate concerns about his appointment, though, of course, it could be that those are being held back because of the police investigation. It is also fair to say that the file's impact are not so much on Lord Mandelson himself as on potentially those still in office who were chatting with him on social media. Let us talk to our political editor, Chris Mason. Morning to you, Chris. The really interesting, Henry Zeffmer was talking to us half an hour ago and saying one of the things that we are going to be amazed by is the simple size of this tranche, this file.
It will be absolutely vast. It'll be colossal. The largest government publication ever put before the Commons, and therefore us, other than the Chilcot Inquiry report into the Iraq War. And to put that into context, that was 12 volumes and 2.6 million words. So we're not quite on that scale, but it is huge. When we got the first tranche, it was, 147 pages, something like that. It'll be around about 1,000. We understand lots and lots and lots of detail. Enormous amounts of material, I'm told, that were sent to London by Lord Mandelson when he was in his post in America, the exchanges with him. And this again, Justin, this sort of bad news boomerang for the government that keeps circling back into ministers' airspace, the Prime Minister's most consequential single judgment in office, it simply won't go away. And here comes the latest case study of it.
And among those documents that there will be, or those messages that there will be revealed today, presumably will be people talking about Keir Starmer, not the man himself, but talking about Keir Starmer to Peter Mandelson.
Yeah, and that's where I think the awkwardness sort of begins for the government today. Plenty in government I talk to are braced for the inevitable awkwardness of exchanges that, you know, were meant to be private and are being catapulted into the light of day. In some instances, excruciating, I'm told. Yes, an insight into how government works, but then on a human level, the tone and tenor of those exchanges. And as you say, what they're talking about, therefore politically embarrassing. Could there be some compare and contrasting to do between messages that were sent to Lord Mandelson when he was sacked and what has been publicly said by those ministers about him since? I hear a good number of cabinet ministers were lavish in his praise of him when he was fired. Now, in their defence, there are those, including strong critics of Lord Mandelson, who say he did a pretty good job in Washington, even if with hindsight it was a catastrophic error of judgment to send him there. So, yeah, here we go again with ministers braced for this deluge that, from their perspective, can only be on scales of bad.
Except that I wonder if they can make the point now, particularly with the passage of time, that actually, and given all the other crises there are, Iran, etc., etc., that actually, really, if this doesn't reveal any kind of hugely damaging new fact, it's just more of the same. And actually, they can make the case, you know what, in the great scheme of things, it doesn't matter.
Yes, I think it is true to say, and I think it has been true to say for a while, arguably, that an element of diminishing returns have kicked in terms of the scale of damage to the government on this. Nonetheless, that's not to say there's much of a positive gloss you can put on this from the government's perspective. So I think in reality, that's how plenty in government see this. They've known this was coming. This has been churning through the system for ages with the whole process of redactions and the involvement of the Intelligence and Security Committee, who have additional clearance for looking at documents in instances like this. So, I think that's probably the best they can possibly hope for around all of this, coupled with the fact that this is pretty much it. So yes, some stuff has been requested not to be published by the police because of the ongoing inquiry, and we should say that Lord Mandelson denies any wrongdoing as far as that is concerned. But this is it in terms of the massive deluge of documents. But of course, with the ongoing investigations and inquiries, it's not quite it as the story is concerned.
Chris Mason, thank you.
14 minutes past seven now. US warplanes have hit fresh targets in Iran overnight, and Iranian drones have been fired once again towards Kuwait. This as the US still insists that progress is being made towards a longer and more solid ceasefire. The Iranians, while more sceptical, aren't fully ruling it out. But how do these regular breaches of the current ceasefire affect all of that? Well, Jeremy Bowen is our international editor. Jeremy, morning. This is happening sporadically but regularly, and it's very hard to know what's happening behind the scenes, because we hear different things from the US and Iranians, the Iranians, when it comes to these talks.
Yeah, we do. And I think that we have to try and strip it back and look at some of the fundamentals that are going on here. First of all, it seems pretty clear that President Trump is deeply reluctant to get back into any kind of sustained military action against the Iranians. He'd like this whole thing to be over. He'd like to find a way out of what actually was a gross miscalculation back in February. On the Iranian side, they have fundamental demands that they believe are existential. And it's pretty clear, I'd say, that more strikes are not going to budge them on that. So what are we looking at? Well, we are looking at the moment, best case scenario is that they do find a way of coming out with this memorandum of understanding, this just essentially an agreement to discuss issues over a longer period, if you like, setting out the parameters, not a peace deal. It's wrong to use that sort of word about it, far from it. And if that doesn't happen, a long period of attrition, either way, if the Strait of Hormuz is not reopened, that is economically disastrous for much of the rest of the world, including the United Kingdom. So, I think we're seeing the consequences of what was a really severe blunder by the Americans and the Israelis to attack Iran back in February. Back in February, they essentially got it wrong because they underestimated the degree to which the Iranians were prepared, the regime was prepared, to ride this out.
And what about the ongoing influence of Gulf states in all of this, Jeremy? As we said, again, it's US interests in Kuwait that are being targeted. And the passage of time has brought out reporting that, in fact, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, have been more involved in this war than they said publicly at the time. What is the feeling among them at the moment?
Well, the UAE and the Saudis have approached it from different angles. The UAE has absolutely doubled down on its strategic relationship with Israelis. The IDF have been in the UAE running their Iron Dome batteries when the war was going on full scale anyway. The Saudis have said that they have attacked Iran, but they have said and made it very clear, and I've certainly had this from very senior Saudi sources, that they made the point to the Iranians that they were not doing it as part of the American-Israeli coalition. They were doing it in response to attacks that Iran had made on Saudi. And the message that they said to the Iranians was, look, we are not part of the coalition, but we are a powerful country. Do not push us too far because there's more stuff that we can do. So, and I think actually you saw fewer Iranian attacks towards the Saudis after that. This is a really difficult and dangerous situation, actually, because this economically vital part of the world, first of all, has taken, if you're asking about the Gulf states, their entire business and development model, which was based on stability, has been badly damaged by this war. With the exception of the UAE, I think that the other countries are thinking, well, sure, we'll try and stay close to the Americans, but we need to diversify quite a bit. And that's why there are talks as well going with Pakistan, with the Turks. So we're seeing this continued period of confusion. And at the center of it is Donald Trump, with his famously limited attention span when it comes to really difficult situations, his desire for quick victories, and in this case, his absolute inability to deliver one.
I just wanted to ask you as well, because we're going to talk about it before 8, Jeremy, the situation in Lebanon, obviously tied to Iran through Hezbollah, but Israeli military incursions continuing deeper and deeper, the territory that they're occupying in Lebanon. How does that, again, reflect on the wider situation in the Middle East at the moment?
Well, to start with, if there was going to be any kind of a deal with Iran, the Iranians all want to put into that basket, as it were, that the Israelis stop what they're doing. I think at the moment, once again, we have to say that there needs to be some kind of sustained period of diplomacy, if that's possible, to try to stabilize things, first of all. But now, at the moment, there's a situation in Lebanon where the Israelis have been, I think, somewhat restrained by the Americans, but they're pushing harder. And the Americans have given this clause, which is, despite the fact there is supposedly a ceasefire, and of course there isn't one really in reality, except in name only, the Americans gave them this clause that they're able to, quote unquote, defend themselves when necessary, which the Israelis have interpreted in an extremely liberal manner in terms of the extent of which they are pushing hard. And the Lebanese government, which is, you know, no, the senior figures in it are no friends of Hezbollah at all, are saying that the Israelis are pushing way too hard, that they're having a scorched earth policy, that they're killing civilians, and all these things I think are clearly true. So again, in all of these things, there isn't a military solution unless Israel, when it comes to Lebanon, is prepared somehow to massively occupy and the country or large parts of it and try to pacify Hezbollah in some way. And that's not going to happen because I don't think they have the capacity or the will to do it. And on a much bigger scale, America is not prepared to send in ground troops and go to war in a major, major way like that with Iran. So if they're not going to be able to deliver military victories, then you have to have political engagement. And both Israel and the United States at this point are not able to do that in a way that goes beyond making very maximalist demands that key parties on the other side of the equation are not prepared to accept.
Jeremy Bowen, thank you. As I mentioned, we will talk more about Israel's military strategy in Lebanon before 8.
It is now 21 minutes past 7. First-time buyers are living through one of the most challenging times to purchase a home. That is what the boss of Britain's biggest house builder told this programme last week. How is that feeding through then into the wider housing market? Fliss is back with more.
Yes, we've just had the latest numbers that give us some insight into exactly that. UK annual house price growth slowed to 1.7% in May, down from 3% in April. That's according to new analysis from Nationwide. Its senior economist Andrew Harvey joins me now. Andrew, good morning. Is it as simple as the Iran war is causing that slowdown in price rises?
Yeah, so the 0.6% fall we saw this month is the first monthly decline we've seen in 2026. And you're certainly right that a lot of the uncertainty caused by developments we've seen in the Middle East and the subsequent rise we've had in energy prices and market interest rates has caused a loss of momentum in the market. We weren't entirely surprised by this. I think it reflects that consumer confidence has weakened noticeably since the start of the conflict. And we've seen consumer confidence at its lowest level since around late 2023 in April. And also measures of sort of housing market sentiment deteriorate as well on the back of that.
Let's talk about first-time buyers then, because David Thomas, the chief executive of Barratt Redrow, told this programme last week that conditions for those buyers are as difficult as they have been since the great financial crisis. Zoopla also said last week there are fewer first-time buyers in the market. What's your data showing?
Yeah, so in the run-up to this sort of crisis, actually, first-time buyer activity had been holding up really quite well. I mean, the housing market has proved pretty resilient in recent years. Household finance is in a pretty solid state. And actually, the picture we had been seeing with affordability is that it had been improving steadily in recent years due to a combination of income growth outpacing household growth and a modest decline in borrowing costs. Obviously, what we've seen recently is a rise in market interest rates driven by swap rates, which underpin them. Mortgage pricing. It is important to note, however, they are well below the levels we reached in 2023, and broadly in line with where we were in 2024. So that's only a partial reversal of those earlier gains. So actually, the affordability picture, whilst clearly it has deteriorated, it is certainly not as bad as it has been in the past.
We're just a few weeks away from the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee making its next decision on whether to hold or change interest rates. Currently, base rate is 3.75%. What are you expecting?
Yeah, so quite an uncertain time at the moment in terms of the outlook for bank rate. A number of policymakers have hinted that they are keen to tighten potentially as an insurance policy against higher inflation becoming embedded. And financial markets currently point to potentially a couple of rises in the next 6 to 9 months. Our view, however, is sort of the generally weak demand situation in the UK and the slack which has emerged in the labour market recently does argue against near-term tightening in rates unless those evidence of second-round effects start to emerge.
Andrew Harvey, senior economist at Nationwide, thank you.
24 minutes past seven is the time. Here is the sound of the deep, dark forest. Well, that was nice, wasn't it? We're actually cheating there because that's a real forest. There are other ghostly forests, though, that are beneath the trees planted in the last century, mostly by timber plantations, ancient woodlands that should be restored, according to campaigners who want the government to help. The model for how it could be done around England comes from Scotland, where it has been done. And Angela Mercer is on the line, who chairs the trustees of the Arc Aig Community Forest, which is near Fort Willing. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. What have you managed to do?
Well, we've had Arc Aig Community Forest for the last 10 years and we work in partnership with the Woodland Trust. But in the last 3 years, we have removed 2,500 acres. We work on 2,500 acres and we have removed 70,000 tonnes of non-native timber from that area.
Wow, which is a huge amount. What did you have to do to get permission to do it?
We bought it from the Forestry Commission, and the timber was due to come out, and you get permission from Scottish Forestry, and in order to do that, you have to either say you're going to restock, or there is going to be regeneration of trees from underneath.
Right. Okay. So two steps then. Number one, you've got to buy the land, the forest. Number two, you've got to make the case for it to be removed and restored. But the gain then is what? Tell us about what you are restoring, what people are going to be able to discover now.
Well, what we're restoring is it was overplanted in the 1970s by the Forestry Commission. It overplanted the ancient Caledonian pinewood that's there. We have two of the remaining 84 fragments of the ancient Caledonian pinewood, which dates from the last ice age. So these are really important fragments. And now that we've taken out the conifers, There are actually quite a lot of trees coming up, and also a lot of the ancient pines are still there.
What, in a fit state to grow?
Yes. There was some trees taken out. Some of the conifers were taken out in the 1980s, and so there was a growth there. So there's some 30-year-old pines growing there. And also we have in the last 3 years, we now have little sort of 3-year-olds coming up from the seed from the ancient trees that are still there.
Amazing. And what do you have to do then to nurture it?
Just remove the trees.
And that's it. You remove the trees, remove the offending trees, as it were, and then just leave it.
We have to remove the there are too many deer still around, so we have to replace the fence, which was broken, and also we have to remove the deer.
Okay, well, look, as I say, it is what you've done is going to be used as a model, apparently, around England as well. So interesting. People will be interested in what you've done and what you've achieved. Angela Mercer, thank you.
It's 28 minutes past seven. It's time for the sport. Carthy's back.
Morning. Very busy weekend. Manchester City women won the domestic double, adding the FA Cup to their Women's Super League title. City beat Brighton 4-0 at Wembley yesterday, and Celtic won the Women's Scottish Cup with a 1-0 win over Rangers. Arsenal's men's team lost the Champions League on penalties to Paris Saint-Germain. That was on Saturday. But yesterday, hundreds of thousands of supporters took to the streets of North London to celebrate Arsenal winning their first Premier League trophy since 2004. So to put the last week and I guess the last season into context, we can speak to the football writer. Morning, Henry Winter.
Morning, Carthy.
Do you think Arsenal will continue to improve on what they've achieved this season, challenging for the biggest title in Europe and attempting to retain the Premier League title, given what we've seen over the last few weeks?
Yes, I think. I mean, they're a very well-run club on and off the pitch. And you look at their policy, which is very much about evolution. They've had three times second finishes in the Premier League, and now they've won it. They've had a quarter-final, a semi-final, and a final, losing semi-final, narrowly on penalties, but deservedly to a very good PSG team. And now the next stage is just to invest in absolute two or three elite players. They've deepened the squad. Now they need to strengthen the first team, maybe tweak the mindset, be a bit more attacking, and go again next season.
Yeah, it was interesting at the end of that Champions League final, the Arsenal manager, Mikel Arteta, first word he said was pain. And then he immediately mentioned decisions that need to be made that demand us to be very ambitious, very fast and very smart, were his words. A direct request to the board, I presume?
Yeah, and I mean, managers normally do that after Champions League games. And what a fantastic run they've had this season. They do need to strengthen, but I think the board might say to them, listen, we do have to balance the books, PSR, sustainability and all that, and there need to be some outgoings as well.
Well, how sustainable is it for Arsenal to stay at this level? And financially, where are they? You mentioned that they're very good both on and off the pitch.
Well, when they got to the last Champions League final in 2006, they were building this new stadium, which drained a lot of money away from Arsene Wenger's plans for the first team. They don't have that problem now. The Emirates, the stadium, is an absolute cash cow for them on non-match days, let alone match days. So they're generating huge sums. I mean, the latest report is that they expect to exceed £770 million in revenue. They'll have made £125 million from the Champions League. Obviously, similar sums in the Premier League. They'll now qualify for the Club World Cup, which is another £100 million, probably. So the money is flowing in, but they need to tweak that first team to take the next step in Europe.
Yeah, and the money that you get from playing in European competitions, as you just mentioned, is huge. Three English teams were in three different European finals this season for the first time. There are nine clubs in European competition next season from the Premier League. What are the likely knock-on effects then for the top flight?
Well, I think it's been a very interesting snapshot of the strength of the Premier League at the moment, certainly in the sort of the middle ranking divisions, the fact that English clubs have won the second and third European competitions. But that top one, when they're up against PSG, who are so well run, who have developed, who've obviously got a lot of state backing behind them, and other teams who are doing up there, English clubs need to go that final step. Look, they won it sort of three times in the last sort of 7 or 8 years, so they have done it. But really, whether it's it's the intensity of the Premier League season, whether it's the sort of the quality of teams they're up against, like PSG, like Bayern, teams like that, they've still got to take that final step.
Yeah. Henry Winter, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. And in the next hour, we will be chatting to Arsenal's CEO, to put that even more into context. A quick bit of tennis news. At the French Open, the teenager Joao Fonseca backed up his big win over Novak Djokovic by defeating the former two-time French Open finalist Casper Ruud to reach the quarterfinals of a Grand Slam for the first time. But the four-time Roland Garros champion Iga Swiatek was knocked out of the tournament by the 15th seed Marta Kostyuk. It's a Grand Slam like I've not seen for a long time, I have to say.
Kathy, thank you. That later this morning, Radio 4 explores how a unique bond shapes our lives.
These relationships with our siblings are really important.
How are we shaped by our brothers and sisters?
Love them or loathe them, your siblings are your siblings.
Anita and Stephen Mangan speak to psychologists and scientists to scrutinise these lifelong relationships.
So if you've got an older sibling who is a child to whom everything comes easily...
Sorry, for the benefit of the radio, I'm pointing to Stephen.
Siblings Unpicked.
You used to sit on me and wouldn't get off until I told you were the greatest.
But I am the greatest, so I mean, that makes sense to me.
Starts this morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On the way, before 8 o'clock, we will hear the story of the Facebook whistleblower who was on stage at the Hay Festival over the weekend for a whole hour, but didn't speak for that entire time.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Anna Foster, Justin Webb. The time is 27 minutes to 8 and Caroline Nichols has the news.
More than 1,000 pages of documents related to Lord Mandelson's time as ambassador to the US are due to be released later today. They're expected to include text messages between ministers and the disgraced Labour peer who was sacked due to his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Senior government figures and civil servants lost their jobs over the appointment of Peter Mandelson, who was given security clearance despite concerns raised by vetting officials. Kuwait's military says its air defences have been intercepting missile and drone attacks. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps has said that it targeted a US airbase in response to an attack over the weekend on Sirik Island in the south of the country. President Trump has repeated his claim that Iran wants to make a deal, which would be a good one for the US and its allies. But in a social media post this morning, he said his political opponents were making it harder for him to do his job and negotiate. Plans for a single patient record for the NHS in England will be debated for the first time by MPs today. The aim is to combine GP, hospital and social care data so patients don't have to keep repeating their story unnecessarily at appointments and doctors can quickly get access to patient information. An investigation by BBC Panorama has found that midwives at an NHS trust in Nottingham wanted pregnant women in early labour to stay at home and wrote an offensive expression against the names of some of them. An independent review into maternity care at the Nottingham University Hospital's NHS Trust is due to be published later this month. The Trust says it's focused on improving care. France has detained a sanctioned Russian oil tanker in the Atlantic with support from British forces. President Emmanuel Macron said it was unacceptable for ships to circumvent international sanctions and fund Russia's war against Ukraine.
Thank you, Caroline. 25 to 8 now. Does the current government strategy for women's health go far enough towards tackling endometriosis? It is the second most common gynaecological condition in the UK. It affects around 1.5 million women. But despite that, the average time to get a diagnosis is nearly 10 years. Well, Emma has a documentary on this tonight. It's on BBC Two, 9 o'clock. And in it, she asks the now former Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, why there isn't a better specific care plan for women with the condition.
Why is there no specific endometriosis pathway?
Well, there should be, I think, is the simple answer to that.
You're the Health Secretary.
But also, some of these are on clinical pathways, these are clinically led decisions as well.
Of course.
So there are some improvements that are coming. Firstly, we should get it right first time. So when a woman goes to see a GP, that GP should then say, OK, I'm going to refer you on to a specialist. So we are now building into the training for GPs those sorts of women's health, gynaecology issues.
But it's a very specific condition. Will you commit to creating an endometriosis pathway specifically, not gynaecology or how you've just described?
Yes, because that should already what you've just described should already exist.
And I'm telling you it doesn't.
And it should, and I accept that.
Well, let's speak to Dame Leslie Regan, who's Professor of Obstetrics and Gynaecology at Imperial College London, also the government's Women's Health Ambassador for England. Dame Leslie, good morning.
Good morning.
I think it's probably worth spelling out, first of all, when Emma talks there about a specific care pathway that exists for other conditions but not for endometriosis, what does that look like? What does a specific care pathway look like?
Well, this is a new national streamlined end-to-end pathway, so that instead of being lost, being sent from pillar to post to different people for different tests, that women are, or can be, if you like, offered pathways that are going to sort their problems out much more swiftly. This has to start, I think, you know, right back at asking women on a regular basis what's happening to their menstrual periods, because as everyone I work with at the Department of Health is sick of hearing from me, there's nothing that happens to a woman quite so commonly as having 12 periods a year for 40 years of your life. And for people like Emma and the women that she interviewed on the programme and worked with, this is really, really disabling, and yet we don't talk about these things nearly enough. So I think it needs to start with young girls who are taught about menstrual health and what is a normal period and what's not a normal period, and about pelvic pain. And it's not normal to be disabled by your period every month. And as we've seen, when those women and girls are not looked after or not listened to, they develop endometriosis, and it can become a very severe and very life-changing disorder.
Mm. So, I mean, when other conditions have these specific pathways, and as we said, endometriosis is the second most common gynecological condition in the UK, why has so much time passed and that not been put in place for endometriosis?
Well, I think we've been very slow to put in quite a few things for women's health, and that's one of the reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing at the moment. And I'm really pleased that we've now had a refresh of the Women's Health Strategy, which initially came out in the summer of 2022, and that has now been refreshed by the current government. But I would be entirely supportive of the view that we're not going fast enough and far enough, and I want to always speed things up.
Mm. So what needs to happen right now to speed things up in the way that you say we really need?
Well, we do need to develop pathways that understand at various different levels, at the very basic level in primary care and in the community, and then at intermediate and more severe levels. We're, as I say, working on a pathway, and we hope that will come out by the end of the year. We also need to do a lot more, I think, about helping women deal with their symptoms whilst they're waiting for treatment or for care. And I think it's also fair to say that we don't have many treatments for endometriosis. And I personally feel that we should be funding an enormous, well, much, much more research into menstrual health, menstrual problems, because endometriosis is one of several very debilitating menstrual problems that really do need to be addressed and need to be simplified for women to access services to. And we need to up our game in terms of researching the underlying problems and diagnoses, and also coming out with innovative new treatment options.
You said that you are hopeful that that pathway would finally be in place by the end of the year. Do you feel that the key organisation is the government to have on board for that. But do you feel that everything is in place as it should be to make that happen on time?
Well, I'm very optimistic about that, because we're working very closely with colleagues at NHS England. And I think that the progress has been really quite good. And as I mentioned earlier, I would always like to get things done by yesterday. But being a realist, we are making good progress. So I think as well the model of women's integrated neighbourhood services, i.e. wrapping services around girls and women, not making them run around different services, and making this much more available closer to home, is also on track to improve things. And we're also looking at a skills framework for professionals or the clinicians who are working within women's health, recognising that there are lots of different people But also, I think thinking about it in a multidisciplinary team approach, because one needs pain management as well as menstrual management and endometriosis and surgery. So there are a lot
of
things,
different things need looking at together. Dame Leslie Regan, thank you for joining us, Professor of Obstetrics and Gynaecology at Imperial College London. Emma's documentary then, BBC Two, tonight. It's on at 9 o'clock. You can also see on the BBC News website where she's written about her own reflections and experiences with endometriosis as well.
18 minutes to 8 is the time. The weirdest thing happened yesterday at the Hay Book Festival. The Facebook whistleblower Sarah Wynne Williams was forced to sit in silence on stage after lawyers advised her not to speak because of legal action brought by Meta, Facebook's owner. Sarah Wynne Williams has a best-selling memoir. It's called Careless People. It details her years working at Facebook. She was due to appear in conversation with two other people, the investigative journalist Carol Cadwallader and the academic Tim Wu. Instead, she sat on the stage for the duration of the hour-long conversation, which was still held between Cadwallader and Wu, without speaking or responding. And get this, she wasn't even able to nod or to shake her head. We did ask her to come on today, but pretty obviously she wasn't able to. Meta, by the way, call the whole book false and defamatory. They point to an interim arbitration award against her, which explicitly prohibits her from promoting her book. Let us talk to her lawyer, Ravi Naik, who is on the line now. Morning to you.
Good morning.
How limited are you in what you can say to us?
Yes, well, it's a very good question, Justin. So firstly, thank you for having me on. And secondly, I'm sorry that my client can't be on. There are things I would like to say about my client, particularly how brave she is and speak to her integrity. And there's lots I'd like to say about Meta and how they've treated my client. But as you point to, Meta has received this arbitration award in California in the US, which extends not just to her, but to her agents, of which I'm one. And that award prevents me from saying anything disparaging about Meta, and it prevents me or my client from promoting her memoir.
Right. So if I ask you about the book, you can't, I'm not going to, but just tell me, if were I to ask you to promote the book now on air, you would have to say I can't.
I would have to say if I were to promote the book, my client, not me, my client could face punitive financial damages as a result.
Right. And that is a real possibility for
her. That is a real possibility, awarded not by a court, but by an arbitration proceeding.
And that's why she couldn't speak or do anything yesterday on the stage.
Indeed. And it's not a hypothetical threat. This is in writing. Meta have said they considered my client's attendance at the Hay Festival a breach of this interim award, and that they would seek sanctions if she were to disparage Meta or denigrate the book, denigrate Meta in any way, or to promote the book.
How would those sanctions be enforced, though?
Well, it's arbitration proceedings, so there would be financial penalty is what Meta was seeking.
And they'd seek it through the British courts?
Well, I mean, it's a quite complicated system, arbitration, but they would seek it in the arbitration proceedings in California, and then they could seek to enforce it through British courts as well. And I should make clear, my client is based in the UK.
Yeah. What Meta say is that this isn't them trying to silence her. It is the arbitration decision. And it was the arbitrator, not Meta, who issued this interim ruling. And it is an interim ruling, isn't it? Which says she shouldn't make disparaging or critical comments about Meta. And they say that is because the case that they have is that the book is false and defamatory. And because of that, it is fair that the arbitration finding is kept to.
Well, I'd say a few things back to that. Firstly, my client has laboured very hard for more than a year now under this award. So she has kept to the spirit and the letter of this award. It's very difficult to do so in circumstance where Meta consider her proximity to a copy of the book to be a breach, which is not hypothetical, it's what Meta have said. Her being in the vicinity of the book is an act of promotion. Secondly, if they consider the book to be false and defamatory, given my client's based in England, why have they not brought defamation proceedings? It's quite an obvious answer to that, that the book is true. My client has an absolute defence to any allegation that the book is defamatory. And thirdly, this is arbitration proceedings to do with a historic employment contract. I've worked in this area for a long time. Never in my life have I faced a circumstance where my client cannot speak about her truth and I, as her lawyer, cannot speak on behalf of my client.
Well, look, thank you very much for talking to us, and we will see what happens next with it, and indeed what the arbitration final decision eventually is and what court decisions are as well. But for the time being, Ravi Naik, thank you very much for talking to us. And that brings us to 14 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Philip North, the Bishop of Blackburn.
Good morning. Football fans are experts in the art of disappointment. When I lived in Sunderland, the football club's fanzine had the title, "It's the Hope That Kills You." That sentiment rang true for me on Saturday night as I watched my favourite Arsenal players miss two penalties and our European Champions League dreams disappear into the Hungarian night air. However, 2 days after that crushing defeat, I'm left wondering if disappointment is all that bad. Yesterday, as hundreds of thousands of Arsenal fans hit the streets to demonstrate their love for their club, we saw how the communal sharing of the whole spectrum of emotions, joy, pain and disappointment amongst them, is one of the ways sport can bind people together. Disappointment can also be powerfully motivational, and I'm sure that, like all the best competitors, the Arsenal players will soon pick themselves up and strive to do even better next season. Many Christian thinkers have argued that disappointment has a positive purpose, even that it's part of God's plan, because it raises in people's hearts deeper questions about the direction and purpose of their lives. Among them, the great 4th century Christian writer and thinker Augustine suggested that disappointment indicates where people have placed their trust in things that are unable to offer lasting fulfilment. Friends, family, and wealth, these aren't bad things. We need them. It's just that they're fragile and so will inevitably let people down. Yet that very disappointment can direct the Christian to the God in whom lasting satisfaction is found. As Augustine wrote in his famous prayer, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you." The story of the disciples on the road to Emmaus illustrates what Augustine is saying. These two are bitterly disappointed after witnessing the death of the one they hoped would launch a revolution. But as they walk along the road, the collapse of their initial expectations leads them to a stunning new realization that Jesus is alive again and that in him all their deepest needs and desires are met. Career, family, politics, all these things will inevitably carry disappointment at some stage. I've met people for whom a profound sense of disappointment has become almost their defining feature. That is a trap that needs to be avoided. Because though it's painful at the time, when channeled in positive ways, disappointment can be transformative, helping people to find a more secure basis upon which to build their lives.
And that was Thought for the Day with Philip North, the Bishop of Blackburn. It brings us to 11 minutes to 8.
Israeli forces have seized a symbolic castle in Lebanon as they push further into the country, while talks continue in Washington between representatives of the governments of both countries. Israeli troops are now operating beyond the demarcation line set out in UN Resolution 1701. That is the Litani River, the area south of which armed groups like Hezbollah should not be operating in. The taking of the Beaufort Ridge, where that castle stands, also raises questions about what Israel's military strategy in Lebanon actually looks like. Well, Michael Herzog was the Israeli ambassador to the United States between 2021 and 2025. He's also a retired brigadier general. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is your assessment of what Israel is trying to do in Lebanon at the moment? Because as we know, Israel's issue is with Hezbollah firing into Israel. But that is Hezbollah, not the Lebanese government. So what are they trying to do in the south of the country?
The situation in Lebanon presents a dilemma for Israel. When Hezbollah started the war, Israeli strategy was to weaken Hezbollah to the point that the Lebanese government could assert its sovereignty and complete the process of disarming Hezbollah. However, this was disrupted by the fact that President Trump acceded to the Iranian demand to link the Lebanese theater to the Iranian theater and to apply ceasefire not only to Iran, but also to Lebanon. So Israel was caught in a situation where it has forces operating in southern Lebanon, But its hands are tied because it cannot apply the full strength of its military operations against Hezbollah. The government has responded with tactical measures, expanding its operations in southern Lebanon, now taking this commanding site of the Beaufort Castle. It's not only symbolic, it's also overlooking southern Lebanon, denying Hezbollah a site from where they could direct fire into Israel. But we are at an odd situation where the U.S. announced a ceasefire, but there's no ceasefire, there's only fire. We lost 13 soldiers since the ceasefire was announced, and people living along the Lebanese border live in bomb shelters all the time.
There is, as you say...
The government has yet to articulate a coherent strategy on Lebanon. I would like to see a strategy combining military measures with diplomacy, which would take time.
I just wanted to tell you, because you won't have seen it, because it's just come in the last few minutes, that Benjamin Netanyahu and Yisrael Katz have said that they have ordered the IDF to now attack Hezbollah targets in the southern suburbs of Beirut. That was something which, during this, as you say, ceasefire in name only, fire has continued, which was not supposed to happen. And again, it raises those further questions that while targeting Hezbollah, there's also a huge number of Lebanese civilians who are targeted and killed and displaced by this as well.
Lebanese civilians are not targeted. It is a very unfortunate, tragic collateral damage from this war, because Hezbollah placed its military command centers and infrastructure within civilian populated areas. I can tell you that our forces operating in South Lebanon, they find rockets and tunnels and military infrastructure in every second house. I've seen that, and it's very troubling. I think we need a long-term strategy with a leading U.S. Role here, which would, on the one hand, apply pressure on Hezbollah. My understanding is that the Lebanese government has the political will to disarm Hezbollah, but they don't have the capability. And you have to build that capability over time.
Yeah, they find themselves in a difficult position. Michael Herzog, thank you for joining us. Former Israeli ambassador to the United States, retired brigadier general as well. Let's also speak to Dr. Firas Abiad, who is a surgeon at the American University of Beirut, but also spent time as health minister in Lebanon's former technocratic government. Dr. Abiad, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little about something that Michael Herzog said there. He talked about Hezbollah's use of medical facilities in the south of Lebanon as a cover for military action. But we also know that health workers, ambulances have been targeted in the last few months as well by Israeli fire.
Well, this is not true. There has been no proof at all of any use of ambulances or medical facilities by Hezbollah or any arms found in any of those sites. And this has been corroborated by Amnesty International and international organizations, including WHO. But Israel, unfortunately, continues to use the pretext to launch this war on Lebanon, clearly not only related to its security, but also to, in our opinion, to derail the whole process between the U.S. and Iran, and also because, and this has been said by some of the people in the current Israeli government, because of they want to annex part of the southern Lebanon. But there is no doubt that the human toll on the Lebanese civilians is very high. UNICEF yesterday or 2 days before issued a report where it's mentioning that every day 11 Lebanese children are being either killed or injured because of what the previous, the ambassador called collateral damage.
I wanted to ask you, Dr. Abiad, as well, from your experience in the government, as we were saying, as a health minister, which you were for several years, you have seen the difficulties that the Lebanese government has in trying to disarm Hezbollah. And as Michael Herzog said, that the will is there. The Lebanese government is trying hard to do this. It is a tricky and difficult thing to do, given the makeup of Lebanese society. How do you think the Lebanese government could could better try and complete what is a very difficult task?
Well, this is not just the Lebanese government. There is clear majority in Lebanon for people who want to end this non-state actors. They want the state to have a monopoly on the use of force. And indeed, as Israel itself said, and the U.S., there is no military solution for Hezbollah. Hezbollah has to be sorted out through a political process that is driven by Lebanese themselves to allow this to happen. But the right environment needs to be present. And the right environment means that Israel needs to stop displacement, needs to stop its attack on civilians, needs to stop its destruction of towns. You know, in southern Lebanon, we have around, between cities and towns, we have around 300 towns. Out of this, 150 of them have been completely razed to the ground by the Israeli forces. Now, this is not conducive for creating the right environment for the Lebanese government to appear as if it's siding with Israel and going in and disarming part of Hezbollah, whose community is actually displaced and whose homes are being razed to the ground. So that's why we need the right environment.
Yeah, as you say, diplomatic as well as military. Dr. Firas Abiad, thank you for joining us, former Lebanese health minister.
On BBC iPlayer.
Gareth. Simple question, really. Do you think you're up to this?
A brand new drama starring Joseph Fiennes and Jodie Whittaker.
Everyone thinks that footballers are overconfident, arrogant. They're afraid.
Based on the award-winning play.
Keep believing. Keep going right up until the final whistle. A new England that comes from behind, that fights.
Dear England.
Are England's young lions ready for the game of their lives?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
2 minutes to eight. Weather time. Simon King.
Justin, thanks so much indeed. Yeah, we've got a real change in the weather this week compared to last week. And of course, today is the first day of meteorological summer. There is some rain in the forecast, and it will be much needed rain actually for parts of East Anglia and the southeast of England, where we've only had about a quarter of the spring average rainfall. So for today, across southern and eastern areas of England, a bit of brightness initially across some eastern areas, but more cloud and some murky conditions down to the southwest. Cloud increasing to all areas. It'll be dry for much of the day, just a few showers, but it's by this evening that we'll see some heavy and thundery showers starting to work their way through, and temperatures getting to about 17 to 23 degrees. For Wales, the Midlands, northwest and northeast England, much of the rain this morning is actually across northern areas of England, but we're now starting to see some showers coming into Wales, more prolonged spells of rain likely later on in the morning into the afternoon, moving their way eastward into the Midlands, and then by this evening some heavy and thundery showers will spread their way eastward as well, with maximum temperatures of 15 to 19 degrees. For Northern Ireland, quite cloudy, a few showers, maybe a few longer spells of rain for a time in the south, sunnier spells they're developing with highs of 18 or 19, and across Scotland, rain in southwestern Scotland spreading north and eastward. It's going to linger in the far northeast of Scotland into the afternoon. Elsewhere, staying cloudy with one or two showers and highs of 15 to 17 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today with Justin Webb and Anna Foster.
It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 1st of June. The headlines this morning: hundreds more official documents relating to the appointment of Lord Mandelson as US ambassador are to be published today, including private exchanges described as excruciating and cringeworthy. The US and Iran have launched attacks on each other's military bases in the Gulf, where Kuwait says it's been intercepting missiles and drones. And MPs will debate today plans for a single patient record for the NHS in England, bringing together GP, hospital and social care information. We'll be talking to the man in charge of all of that, the new Health Secretary for England, at 8:10.
Also coming up in the next hour, the story of a much longed for phone call.
They're saying how pretty I am. And I can make her a stone.
That is the comedian Shappi Khorsandi. You'll remember last week on the programme she told us about her excruciating wait to speak to family in Iran. And this morning she will tell us about the moment that she reconnected with them. We'll talk to her at 20 past eight. And Karthi has got a very special guest from a very big sporting weekend.
Indeed. Joy on the streets of North London yesterday. Hundreds of thousands of fans celebrated Arsenal's first Premier League trophy in over 20 years. We'll be speaking to the club's CEO, Richard Garlick, about this season's achievements.
Before that, the BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
More than 1,000 pages of documents related to Lord Mandelson's time as ambassador to the US are due to be released today. They're expected to include text messages between ministers and the disgraced Labour peer. Senior government figures and civil servants lost their jobs over the appointment of Peter Mandelson, who was given security clearance despite concerns raised by vetting officials. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
The release of some of the Epstein files in the US revealed the extent of Lord Mandelson's friendship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein and led to his sacking. This tranche of documents, amongst the largest ever laid in Parliament, will give us details of the discussions around the peer's appointment, as well as an insight into his time as the UK's man in Washington. It will contain emails, briefings and memos, as well as pages of messages on what seems to be the government's preferred communications platform, WhatsApp. Senior government sources have conceded the tranche will include details of exchanges which are, in their words, embarrassing and cringeworthy. Lord Mandelson's vetting file will not be included. It's understood the Met Police have asked for it to be held back while they investigate him on suspicion of misconduct in a public office. He has denied wrongdoing. Other disclosures will be redacted on grounds of national security or international relations, such as private messages which could be critical of President Trump.
Kuwait's military says its air defences have been intercepting missile and drone attacks. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps has said that it targeted a US airbase in response to an attack on Sirik Island in the south of the country. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell.
This is the third known military escalation between the US and Iran in the space of a week. Kuwaiti state media reported that sirens were sounding across the country this morning. US Central Command then stated that it had carried out what it described as self-defense strikes at two Iranian drone command and control sites over the weekend. It said this was in response to what it called aggressive Iranian actions, including shooting down a US drone over international waters. The latest developments underline the fragility of the ceasefire between the US and Iran, as negotiators on both sides have appeared to edge towards a deal to extend it.
President Trump has repeated his claim that Iran wants to make a deal, which would be a good one for the US and its allies. But in a social media post this morning, he said his political opponents were making it much harder for him to do his job and negotiate. Satellite images and videos analysed by BBC Verify show that Iran has damaged 20 US military sites since the start of the war. They suggest the attacks are more extensive than publicly acknowledged. Our correspondent Melin Thomas has more details.
Iran has targeted key US facilities across eight countries in the Middle East since the war began in February, causing millions of dollars of damage to state-of-the-art air defence systems, refuelling aircraft and radars. The Supreme Leader has sought to highlight his military success, while the White House has repeatedly claimed Iran's military has been almost wiped out. But experts say while Iran started off using sprawling barrages of attacks, it shifted to more precise, targeted hits on high-value equipment. Among the US hardware damaged was three state-of-the-art anti-ballistic missile battery systems, each of which cost more than $1 billion. The US declined to comment on our findings, citing operational concerns.
The Lebanese president, Joseph Aoun, has said that his country is facing what he called a vicious and reprehensible Israeli aggression. Israel has stepped up its offensive against Hezbollah, pushing further north in Lebanon and seizing the 900-year-old Beaufort Castle. In the past hour, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has said he's ordered strikes on Beirut's southern suburbs. The UN Security Council is due to hold an emergency meeting on the fighting. Plans for a single patient record for the NHS in England will be debated for the first time by MPs today. The aim is to combine GP, hospital and social care data so people don't have to keep repeating their story at appointments and doctors can quickly get access to patient information. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
A&E doctors are frustrated that they sometimes can't get access to patients' GP records. Under this plan, they'll quickly be able to check complete histories, medication and allergies for those needing urgent care. Paramedics will be able to see full information on a patient they're blue lighting to hospital. In some parts of England, there's already limited shared data, but the aim is to ensure consistency across the whole system. The Department of Health says the risk of misdiagnosis will be reduced, meaning fewer patients going to A&E, and GPs will save time because they'll obtain full patient histories more quickly. But the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, said there were real concerns about security and confidentiality, and there'd have to be assurances that patient data would not be used inappropriately.
An investigation by BBC Panorama has found that midwives at an NHS trust in Nottingham wanted pregnant women to stay at home and wrote an offensive expression against the names of some of them. The programme has spoken to 10 former staff at the trust. An independent review into maternity care at Nottingham University Hospital's NHS Trust, examining 2,500 cases, is due to be published later this month. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
The attitude of some maternity staff to women in early labour is revealed in a resignation letter from a midwife written in 2018. She said one midwife wrote FOH on a whiteboard beside some women's names, an offensive acronym showing they wanted the women to go home. Some former employees say the poor attitude stemmed from a lack of staff. The chief executive of the trust, who started after the maternity inquiry was announced, said the organisation had to take responsibility for its past failures and that he was focused on improving care now.
You can see Panorama, Maternity Failures, The Fight for Justice tonight at 8 o'clock on BBC One and on iPlayer now. France has detained a sanctioned Russian oil tanker in the Atlantic Ocean. It said the vessel was intercepted 400 miles off Brittany with support from British forces. Barry Caffrey reports.
President Emmanuel Macron said that the tanker, the Tagore, was detained yesterday morning in international waters with the help of Britain and other partners. In a social media post, the French leader said it was unacceptable for ships to circumvent international sanctions, violate the law of the sea, and fund the war that Russia has been waging against Ukraine for more than 4 years. President Macron also said the vessels of Russia's shadow fleet did not comply with the most basic rules of maritime navigation and posed a threat to the environment and the safety of everyone.
Russia says it will stop exporting jet fuel for the next 6 months to ensure stability in its domestic market. Russia is the world's fourth largest producer of jet fuel. The parents of a teenager who died from a severe reaction to sesame are opening today a £10 million prize in her name to try to create a future without food allergies. Natasha Ednam-Laperouse collapsed after eating a baguette at an airport, Pret-a-Manger, which wasn't labelled with its ingredients. Applications are welcomed from scientists worldwide, regardless of their field of research. Rebecca Drought reports.
Food allergy cases have doubled in a decade in the UK, according to Natasha's foundation. The charity set up in the name of the 15-year-old who died in 2016 says 1 in 13 children are now affected. Previous research suggests the causes of food allergies include changes to our environment, a diet filled with ultra-processed food, and changes to our immune systems. But scientists believe they are preventable. Natasha's prize, which has been funded by donations, aims to answer the question, what interventions can be made in the first 1,000 days of life that could stop them developing at all?
Rebecca Drought reporting.
Thank you for that. It is 8:10. It is not one of the great offices of state. It's not the Home Office, the Foreign Office, the Chancellorship. But to be Secretary of State for Health in England is to be in charge of an organisation of staggering size and complexity, but also one that people care hugely about. And today, another big moment in its history. The bill that establishes a single patient record in England goes before the Commons. In theory, every doctor would then be able to see a whole record when you show up in hospital. Potentially good news, though not itself without controversy. And of course, there is potentially bad news as well, and the fact that more strikes are now being planned by resident doctors. It would be the 16th round of them, resident doctors, what we used to know as junior doctors. And the man in charge, the man who took over, of course, when Wes Streeting resigned, is James Murray. Secretary of State for Health and Social Care in England. And Mr. Murray is on the line. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
Are you daunted? Because it's not that you had no responsibilities before. You were a Treasury Minister. It was an important role. But this is huge, isn't it?
This is huge. And this matters to all of us. You know, you don't have to convince anyone why the NHS is so important. And, you know, when I speak to people about my job now, within moments of saying what my job is, people talk about their experience of the NHS, you know, how it's helped them, how they would change it for the better, you know, what they think about what we're doing as a government, because everyone really cares about this. And it's a deeply personal issue for me, as it is for people across the country. And I'm really honoured to be doing this role.
Are you continuity Wes Streeting or something else?
I'm continuity Labour government, because what we've done in the first 2 years is we've got a waiting list down, 500,000 people off waiting lists in the first 2 years. We've made real progresses on the back of record investment in the health service and beginning our work of transforming and modernising the NHS. You know, what I see my job as being now is to maintain those improvements in performance and also to push forward with the modernisation and reform of the NHS, including the single patient record, which we'll be debating the legislation for in Parliament this afternoon.
OK, well, you certainly are continuity Labour government when it comes to the Resident Doctors Committee, the BMA, because they've already met you, haven't they? He had a genuine opportunity, they say, of you to break this logjam over the strikes, fresh energy and ambition. He has not taken it.
Well, look, can I just say that I'm really disappointed that the resident doctors have decided to go on strike, because I met them last week to talk through where we're at in terms of the negotiations. And I said, look, I know from my position, having been a Treasury Minister until a few weeks ago, that where we've got to in terms of pay is a really good offer. You know, resident doctors have had a pay increase of 28.9% over the last 3 years. What is on the table is an average 4.9% increase this year. On top of that, rises to over 7% for some of the lowest paid resident doctors. It's a very strong offer when it comes to pay. We've moved a long way on that. I said to the BMA Resident Doctors Committee that, you know, my door is open to discussing other elements of the offer around career progression, around training opportunities, working conditions, so we can make the offer as strong as possible for resident doctors, reflecting the important
line,
work they do.
Say, vagueness on new jobs, no further money on the table.
No, I made very clear to them that I would have those discussions, my team would have those discussions about the specifics of the offer, about what specifics they want in the rest of the offer when it comes to job opportunities, training possibilities, and so on.
Right. Very clear this morning, on the money side of it, there is no shift from a Keir Starmer government, essentially.
Yeah, we are not in a position to go any further. When we're facing global instability, when families across the country are feeling the pinch, this is a very good offer when it comes to pay, and we are not in a position to go further.
Another thing that is potentially bad news, well, is bad news, because bad news for many women having babies at the moment, is the state of NHS maternity care, which I don't think anyone would suggest is in an ideal position. And of course, there are these reports coming in, and indeed there's a panorama this evening, which suggests, I suppose, well, let me ask you, is it a cultural problem? Because the panorama has talked to people who talk of midwives just treating women with complete contempt, essentially. How root and branch has the reform got to be to our maternity services?
I think the reform has to be comprehensive. You know, this is not a case of just identifying one or two things we need to do. This has to be a comprehensive reform to maternity services. And if I can just say this, that, you know, my first few days as health secretary, I chaired the task force, which is going to be overseeing our comprehensive plan to improve maternity services, and meeting there some of the families who had been affected, whose babies had died, mothers, fathers. Horrific. You know, it really struck me. And when you're a Secretary of State, you know, a lot of the job is about looking at papers and budgets and so on. This brings it home in the strongest possible sense how human and how devastating this can be, and how important it is that we change. And people don't want to see recommendations on shelves. People want to see a comprehensive plan of what we're going to do.
Exactly.
To
and I suppose the question is whether you can assure them this morning that that will happen, given that Wes Streeting was very committed to all of this and then suddenly he's gone, and they will feel, well, we've had the rug pulled out from under us again.
Yeah, and it's really important that I reassure families that they have no reason to feel that way, because this is a priority for me too. And I don't want to lose a second in terms of moving forward with what we need to do. We know that Baroness Amos is undertaking her review at the moment. There's a review in Nottingham. We want to bring together all of these reviews into the National Task Force and make sure we have a comprehensive plan developed with me as chair, involving families, involving experts, and my commitment to making sure that process goes forward is absolute.
We've got this NHS modernisation bill before the Commons today, and we were hearing earlier in the programme, and from the union unison, a welcome for the general idea that, that doctors can access records, but great fears about Palantir, this American company that's already been involved in some NHS work, and indeed a direct call from unison that Palantir be ruled out of taking part in these measures. Will you rule it out?
Well, I think it's a very different situation than the federated data platform, which is where Palantir are currently involved, because you know that federated data platform where Palantir are currently involved, that's a single contract with Palantir, and it's being reviewed at the moment ahead of its breakpoint next year. The single patient record will be operated in a very different way, where there will be contracts with many different providers to de-risk the delivery.
But will Palantir be one of them?
Well, look, I'm not going to make sort of commercial judgments at this stage, but I don't want to underline how different the situation
is. But just to, I mean, sorry to interrupt you, and I'll let you answer this completely, but the call that we heard earlier in the programme from Unison was for Palantir to be ruled out. And the reason given was that the things they do outside the NHS, it's nothing to do actually with what they're doing inside the NHS, that outside the NHS, the corporate values of that organisation do not align with those of the NHS. That's the point that Unison make. But you, I think I'm right in saying this morning, are saying, no, don't go so far. If Palantir are right, we will use them.
What I'm saying is that the process of letting the contracts for delivering the single patient record hasn't even begun yet. And I don't think you would expect me to make sort of commercial judgments at this stage.
Well, what about staff members who at the moment are at least threatening, and indeed some cases I think actually are, not using Palantir kit? What do you say to them?
I would say that this is a very different project. Single patient record is a very different mechanism of delivery. It will be through lots of contracts with different providers who will help us deliver this across the country. And what it's fundamentally about is making sure that at the moment we have a fragmented system where GPs and different hospital trusts and care providers, they all hold their data on people in a very fragmented way. What this is about is linking them up, so that in future, clinicians can look at that data all in one place and take better, quicker, safer decisions about what treatment patients need. It means that we all as patients don't have to repeat our symptoms and our concerns and our stories time and again. And it means that in a few years' time, we will be able to see our data on the NHS app, so we'll be in control of our health records.
So let me put it like this then, without mentioning Palantir, just when you make those decisions and when individual companies are involved, you're saying to health service staff, you must work with those companies that we decide.
Well, there'll be a commercial process of procurement to put those companies in place.
And then they will have to work with them.
But we're not going with one individual. We're not going with one big contract. You know, this is not like the situation with the federated data platform, which is where the Palantir contract has been let. This is a case of going with lots of different providers to help us deliver this overall infrastructure. And it won't actually transfer where the data is. I think this is an important point, because the data, which is currently held by GPs, by hospitals, by care providers, the data will still stay with them. This is about the infrastructure for connecting that data. So the data will still stay where it is now. This is about the pathways, the spokes, if you like, connecting all this data together, so that someone sitting in the middle, looking in the app, a clinician looking at your record, can have a view of all of that data at one time, at the same time, to make the best possible decisions for your care.
Just in the terms of introducing yourself to people and your views and where you're coming from, your predecessor, Wes Streeting, many years ago said that trans women are women. And then he said, actually, he changed his mind before the last election. He said it's more complex than that. You also have said in the past trans women are women. Do you keep to that? Have you changed your mind?
Yeah, I have changed what I would say. I wouldn't say that phrase anymore. And I think that, you know, over the last few years, I think a lot of us, myself included, have thought about this question in quite some detail. The Supreme Court has obviously ruled very clearly that biological sex is what matters when it comes to the Equality Act and determining the importance of single-sex spaces. You know, I believe that single-sex spaces should be protected on the basis of sex, on the basis of biological sex, whilst at the same time believing in dignity for trans people, recognising that sex and gender are different things, but being absolutely clear that single-sex spaces within the NHS, for instance, need to be protected on the basis of sex.
And just a final thought about the wider political story today, Peter, this cache of stuff that's coming from Peter Mandelson, or at least from his text messages and other messages that he's had with government ministers. Are you prepared for embarrassment? Are you prepared for personal embarrassment? Have you been in touch with him?
I don't think I'll be embarrassed by it. I think, you know, what's important in terms of the government's response is that we honour our commitment to transparency, that we put all of that information out there in the public. You know, we have fully acknowledged, and the Prime Minister has been very clear, that the decision to appoint Lord Mandelson was wrong. Parliament has taken a view on publishing this information. The government is fully supportive of that, and the Cabinet Office is completing that process, and the information will be published soon.
James Murray, Secretary of State for Health and Social Care in England. Thank you very much.
It's 22 minutes past eight now. We've been talking on the programme this morning about US warplanes hitting fresh targets in Iran overnight. We've talked about Israel's military strategy in Lebanon. You will remember last week on the programme, we spoke to the comedian and author Shaparak Horsandi about one of the very human stories that comes from these times that we find ourselves in at the moment. She's been struggling to keep in touch with family in Iran after months of the internet being disconnected there amid protests, amid war. And the good news is she has now managed to reach them.
They're saying how pretty I am.
Andak,
Oh, it would seem like an intrusion to talk over that wonderful moment of joy. Shappy joins us again. Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, how lovely to hear that. You could just, the joy that radiates out of every single voice that you could hear in that sort of 28 seconds, it really says a lot.
Well, it's, I mean, what are we without our families and the people who love us and whom we love, you know? It's been extraordinarily hard. It's been an extraordinarily hard 47 years, but at least we could speak. But the lack of contact, the internet blackout was it was agony.
We should say as well for people who follow this but maybe don't follow every twist and turn for it, this has been pretty much since the start of the year, since the protest started. This is the Iranian regime essentially switching off the internet for ordinary people across the country. When you haven't got that, as you say, there's just no way to get in touch, is there?
You don't know who's alive, you don't know who's dead, you don't know what they're suffering. You don't know what they're going through, and it's dementing. And that is that. That's what this regime does. It knows the psychological impact it has on people, and that's what it does. And it's an absolute horror show. And when we did speak to them, past the singing, and when I asked serious questions, there was a real fear of the regime, even on the phone. I actually asked my cousin if she would consider coming on the radio with me, and she was, "Shappy, I'll get hanged." You know, I'm laughing as I say that, but that's their reality. One step out of line and you're dead, you know. And what they really spoke about was the economic hardship that people are suffering there, factories that have been bombed. But the protests, the impact of the protests has been the most seismic thing for them. The blackout during that, my the younger members of my family were out in the protest. They have experienced horrors that no young person should experience and see. And that for me was so devastating to be confirmed. And, you know, we have history of this in our family. My 19-year-old uncle back in 1979 was killed out protesting. And obviously our story is not unique. So for Iranians, the protests, whatever side you're on, whether you are a left winger or a monarchist, those protests and the sheer amount of people that were killed by the government has been absolutely dementing and isolating in terms of living in exile, living away, and hearing the silence from people that I am mostly politically aligned with. The absolute silence from the left around the protests has been, very heartbreaking. So to hear it from them, first-hand accounts of the protests was really dark. And the economic hardship that people in the whole country are experiencing. And of course, with the blackouts, it was impossible to send money to family as well. So that's something else that, we had to endure, not knowing if they had enough to eat.
Yeah. Yeah. As you say, it's a blackout in so many ways. And I think the point that you make as well is an important one, that even though two things, actually, even though the internet is back, it doesn't mean that people can suddenly speak freely, because they can't.
Absolutely.
And also, just because the internet is back now does not mean to say that it will stay on. There's every chance that you could just lose them again, which must be awful.
Yeah. We've constantly, the sword of Damocles above our heads with this regime constantly. We just don't know. And also, one thing I do want to say as well, with the Iranian people, our culture, a cousin has almost equal billing with a sibling. So this family matters so enormously, and so you can't quite get on with your ordinary life knowing that this is going on for them, and just the circumstances under which we were separated and never forgotten either. Very few Iranians chose this separation with the country. Most of us here are exiled for one reason or another. And what I have found is the connections between Iranians here, my own personal connections have really strengthened. I've gained a lot of solace from it, and people who really understand, and just a much more awareness of support out there. And because people can feel very polarized on the internet. Sometimes it's felt like you didn't know where to turn to find people that you can have long form conversations with about this,
yeah,
or about anything, frankly.
Yes. So it's not always the place for thoughtful discourse, is it? It has to be said. I thought, just to, when we heard you last week as well, and it was clear how difficult this is for you, and then to hear you, those moments of joy when times are so, it seems they're so relentlessly bleak at the moment, but to hear you and them there, and the happiness. What the song, by the way, because they were singing in Farsi there, and you were doing a bit of translation. What was the singing? Was some sort of kind of celebratory song, was it?
That I'm pretty like my mother. It's very important. At 52, I really do rely on my family to keep telling me how pretty I am. So
I think
that was
we all do.
A delight. That was a delight. But the song that I sung that we were singing was a very old Iranian folk song. And actually, the translation is slowly, slowly, the mass of the drinkers, of the mei, like drink in Persian poetry is treated very, with great respect, the art of drinking and being drunk, being an altered state of reality. All the great poets talk about it, wine. And Shiraz wine, of course. Shiraz is a region of Iran. But anyway, so it's about slowly that we gather. May Padastan, the worshippers of the wine, the grape, gather. And it's an old, very, very old Iranian folk song that I'm probably murdering the translation
of. It sounded perfect for the moment. And, Shappi, I'm so glad that you did get to speak to them. And I'm so glad that you came back to tell us about it. And I hope there are many more conversations like that. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
29 minutes to 9 is the time. Here's Cathy with the sport.
Morning, thank you very much. As mentioned, over the last few hours, it has been a big cup weekend across several sports. The BBC Sport website has all of the headlines, but we are going to focus on Arsenal. They were involved in the most prestigious of the European competitions. They lost the Champions League final on penalties to Paris Saint-Germain on Saturday. But yesterday, hundreds of thousands of supporters took to the streets of North London to celebrate with the club as Arsenal showed off their first Premier League trophy in 22 years, as well as celebrating winning the Women's Champions Cup during an open top bus parade. And I'm very pleased to say we can speak to the Arsenal CEO Richard Garlick. Good morning, Richard.
Morning, Cathy.
Obviously, there's disappointment from the weekend and losing the Champions League final in such a brutal way, but Arsenal are Premier League champions. What was the feeling at the club yesterday after such an up and down few days?
It was a huge feeling of immense pride. Pride in the team, in Mikel and his staff and the players, but also, I think, pride across the whole club, everybody involved in Arsenal. You saw the scenes yesterday, completely unprecedented. And it's not just around Islington and North London. It's stretched across the globe in Africa and in New York. I think the Empire State Building was lit up in red. It's immense pride and satisfaction in winning the Premier League after a 22-year wait.
Yeah, and on Saturday, Declan Rice and Mikel Arteta were talking about how far the club has come over the last few seasons, that quarter-final, semi-final, final in the Champions League. Arsenal were 1-0 up in the final on Saturday. They scored 6 minutes in. Then it went to extra time, penalty shootout, and Gabriel's penalty was the one that was missed. How are the team reflecting on that performance on Saturday, or is that to come this week?
I think they were reflecting on Saturday after the match. There was obviously disappointment. Losing on penalties, as you say, is a cruel way of losing any final. But they also recognise the progression that's been made over the last few years. It's been a journey. It's been a long journey. It's taken a lot of people, a lot of effort, a lot of investment, a lot of emotional investment to get there as well. Everyone is just so proud that all that hard work has paid off. And they'll look forward. They'll reflect on that. They'll be stronger. And there's a hunger to come back next year to win not just one more trophy, but more trophies for now and for a long time in the future.
And you mentioned how long it's taken. Your manager, Mikel Arteta, won the FA Cup in his first season in 2020. He's now brought them a first Premier League title in 22 years. It shouldn't be unusual, but it is, to stick with a manager for that amount of time without winning another major trophy. Why were you so convinced that Arteta would get to this point?
I think we all knew that certainly when I joined the club, there was a clear plan. There was a clear process. That process would take time. Our owners are incredibly loyal. They value stability. And I think you can see that Arsenal, compared to its rivals, has benefited from that stability over the last 3 years. In Mikel, you have somebody who's got a huge desire to win, to better themselves every day. He's pushing everybody around the club to be better, to improve, to move forward. He's relentless in that. And I think we all knew that it was going to take a little bit of a time to get there, but we would get there in the end. We needed to trust the process, as we used to say. And that's now shown that it's translated into this fantastic win.
Yeah, you went from director of football to MD to CEO. I think we can hear the pride in your voice. Arteta's current contract runs until the end of next season. We've already heard from the Arsenal co-chair, Josh Kroenke, who said keeping him is an utmost priority. Is that your first piece of business for this summer, now that you've sort of got the football out of the way?
There's plenty of work for us to do in the summer moving forward. We as a club, our mindset is always forward. If you stand still, you go backwards. And certainly sitting down with Mikel and agreeing how we're going to manage this club going forward in the long term is number one. But there's also going to be further investment in the squad. As I say, we're not going to sit here and just accept winning one trophy. We want to go and win major trophies now and, as I say, in the future.
But you do have to keep Mikel Arteta in order to do all of that, don't you?
We our intention is to work with Mikel and build it and build on the club moving forward. He's as I say, he's done a fantastic job. He's great to work with, and yeah, we want to build something moving forward together and create a real legacy at the club.
You talked about the finances. What is the club's financial strategy? You're heading towards breaking the Premier League record for the highest revenue generated in a season. How can you invest in the team, win trophies, do that in a sustainable way, presumably without trying to sell players, or do you have to sell players?
It's a combination of different factors. We talk at the club around a strategy of winning financially. We want to generate more revenue so that we can invest it back into the club, in both in relation to the playing staff, men's and women's team, the facilities, in to ensure that we've got the best possible people and the best possible facilities. And it is a challenge, but we're very fortunate. You know, we've got a fantastic global fan base, and we've got a huge, you know, a great stadium. We're incredibly well supported. And, you know, over recent times, we've partnered with some really excellent companies. I think you can see the quality of the partners that we've got, and that continues to grow. You know, it's a great time to be at Arsenal. It's a great time to work with Arsenal. It's a great time to be part of the Arsenal family.
Yeah, and that well-supported, you mentioned. How important was Arteta in changing the club's connection with the fans? There were protests. The club was finishing in eighth place, then fifth, then second. That reconnection wasn't just about results, was it?
No, not at all. It's something Mikel's felt very strongly about. You know, that support fuels the team. It gives them energy. And he wanted to ensure that we had that connection. And that connection comes about in a number of different ways. It's the way we turn up. It's the what we say. It's how we act. It's little things like putting on open training at the start of this season, or taking the team over to Asia and developing the fan base over there. Right back to having our own supportive advisory group, you know, engaging with the supporters, being honest, being transparent with them. And, you know, that's from Josh Kroenke, who attends a lot of those meetings, to myself. We feel that we need to have a genuine, authentic connection with the fans. And I think you saw yesterday the output of that strategy. It was incredible scenes. I've never seen anything like it in North London or anywhere else around the world.
Yeah, it was great to see. And that connection goes across the women's team as well. They were part of the parade that yesterday with the Women's Champions Cup. All of their home games are being played at the Emirates. Why is that so important in terms of the long-term growth of a club like Arsenal?
The women's team's always been at the heart of Arsenal Football Club. We champions women's football. It's a key strategic pillar for us. Everybody knows that we want to grow the game. We want to develop the game so that we see ourselves as, I suppose, a bit of leaders in that case, where we're leading from the front. We wanted to play all the matches at the Emirates. We wanted the Emirates to be the home of Arsenal Women's Football Club. And I think you can see that we averaged around 35,000 fans attending every week on the women's team. And I think if that translated into the men's team, we'd be about eighth in the attendance league.
Yeah, back-to-back titles then, Premier League titles for Arsenal?
As I say, we're always looking to go forward. We absolutely want to win more trophies. This is, it's a great time for Arsenal Football Club. And we've got that desire and that hunger to defend our title and, as I say, win more trophies in the future.
Yeah, well, it's great to speak to you. Richard Garlick, CEO of Arsenal, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Cathy. It's 21 minutes 9. It's Monday morning, which means Start the Week is here at 9 o'clock. And Tom Sutcliffe is in to tell us more. Morning, Tom.
Morning, Anna. We're talking about the question of the moment this morning. How do we shape an economy so that it does what we want it to? Even members of the same party can't agree about that. More shots fired over the weekend in the Labour Party debate, started by Tony Blair's essay. I can't promise consensus from our guests this morning, but I can promise some fresh ideas. In a new book, Jeremy Hunt, Chancellor of the Exchequer under Rishi Sunak, asks, can we be rich again? And his answer is yes, possibly, but obviously only if we follow his advice. And Professor Mariana Mazzucato offers an alternative route to a better future and a new compass to guide us in her book, The Common Good Economy. And the financial journalist Patrick Foulis is with us to talk about whether we actually get any real choice about which direction we go in a globalised world. That's Start the Week just after 9. Sunlit uplands, maybe.
Maybe. Something to look forward to, at least. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna and me and Caroline with the news.
More than 1,000 pages of documents related to Lord Mandelson's time as ambassador to the US are due to be released later today. They're expected to include text messages between ministers and the disgraced Labour peer. Senior government figures and civil servants lost their jobs over the appointment of Peter Mandelson, who was given security clearance despite concerns raised by vetting officials. Kuwait's military says its air defences have been intercepting missile and drone attacks. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps has said that it targeted a US airbase in response to an attack on Sirik Island in the south of the country. Plans for a single patient record for the NHS in England will be debated for the first time by MPs today. The aim is to combine GP, hospital and social care data so people don't have to keep repeating their story at appointments and doctors can quickly get access to patient information. The Health Secretary for England, James Murray, told us it was his job to push forward modernisation and reform.
Thank you, Caroline. 19 minutes to nine. There are calls at Holyrood for a parliamentary inquiry into the embezzlement of around £400,000 from the SNP by its former chief executive, Peter Murrell. The SNP's former leader, his ex-wife, Nicola Sturgeon, told Laura Koonsberg on Sunday that she was being treated like a criminal for a crime that she did not commit and that she was not responsible for righting the wrongs of her former husband.
Should donors to the SNP whose money was spent criminally get their money back? Would you contribute to that in some way?
What do you mean, would I contribute to that in some way?
Well, you still have the asset of your marital home.
Marital home wasn't bought by SNP. There will now be, I would imagine, a legal process to recover the money from Peter that he embezzled from the SNP. So that will be a legal process. I am not guilty of that embezzlement, so nothing that belongs to me should be part of that, rightly.
Well, opposition figures in Scotland still believe that Nicola Sturgeon has questions to answer on this. Jackie Bailey's MSP, Deputy Leader of Scottish Labour. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
What are those questions that, because she had a long conversation with Laura Koonsberg, as we heard, lots of those questions were put to her. What do you still want to hear answers to?
Well, it was a very interesting interview, and of course Nicola Sturgeon was accompanied by her lawyer, as I understand it. Firstly, I think she should apologise to those who made donations to the SNP's Independence Fund, and those donations have simply vanished. And she should apologise to the country, because what we consistently see from the SNP is spin, secrecy and cover-up. And let me make clear, this is not because she is responsible for her husband's crimes, although she did benefit from them, but she should be held responsible because she's leader of her party and she is the former First Minister. And in that role, she blocked any scrutiny, legitimate scrutiny, of her party's finances. And in fact, she bullied and intimidated those who raised questions. And had they been allowed to progress, then perhaps the embezzlement wouldn't have taken place. Now, I've been calling for a parliamentary inquiry because I think there are questions that remain to be answered. Why did the police investigation take 5 years and cost over £2 million? Why did the Crown Office, working in agreement with Peter Murrell's lawyers, delay the court appearance until after the election when it was scheduled to appear before that? And this strikes to the heart for me of trust in our politicians and in our political institutions.
Yeah, I know that you want this parliamentary inquiry to happen, and I know you're pushing for a majority on it, which I know you know you're unlikely to get, because not every other political party in Scotland is going to back you on it. I do wonder, though, you talked about that police inquiry lasting 5 years, costing £2 million. But the access that they have, the legal access that they have to data and evidence, would presumably be greater than you would get with a parliamentary inquiry. So what do you think that you could uncover that would not already have been looked at by the police?
So I don't want to rerun the criminal investigation. That wouldn't be appropriate for a parliamentary inquiry. But the Parliament does have powers to compel witnesses and to compel the submission of evidence. What I want to look at is the governance arrangements that clearly were not in place, that failed, the cover-up that led to this happening in the first place. And actually, there could well be public money involved, because the SNP received short money from Westminster. They also receive money from the Electoral Commission. We need to be sure that every question is answered, and a parliamentary inquiry would get us to that place.
Jackie Bailey, MSP, the Deputy Leader of Scottish Labour. Thank you for joining us.
And the time. And the-
And the time is 9:15.
It was 10 years ago this month that saw, well, what was one of the most consequential political events in Britain this century so far, the Brexit referendum. And next week, there is a new BBC documentary series looking back on it, produced by the veteran multi-award-winning filmmaker Norma Percy. It's called Brexit, A Very British Civil War, and it's had unique access to all of the key players, Lord Cameron, Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage and more. Now, I've been speaking to her, along with Max Stern, who's the series director, and you will hear some of those interviews as well. But I asked Norma, first of all, what she wanted to try and capture in this series.
For more years than I care to remember, I've been trying to show on television what it's like inside the room when the really big decisions are made. I mean, for the first time, I really felt, say, Boris Johnson was looking back into the memory, remembering what it was like 10 years ago.
It was then that I really felt the strength of people's feeling about this. I underestimated how deeply it spoke to people.
I felt like he was really racked, like you can possibly question his motives. But there's no question, listening to him, that he was truly undecided and trying to make the best decision.
And it's the recollections of these key figures that really, really sheds light, doesn't it, Max? Because it's such a heavily discussed topic. We feel like we've heard everything there is to know, but actually the stories from those really important players, that's what makes it different. Actually learning, as Norma says, what happened in the room.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, the interviews in this series in particular were quite different in a way to other political interviews that Norma and I have done for series in the past. I think because it was such a personal story for everyone. And, you know, Boris Johnson, for example, ended up giving us 3 hours of interview time, which is quite extraordinary, really.
Everybody says, I did this in order to be PM. I would have become Prime Minister anyway.
He, I think, enjoyed it in a funny way as well, which is not always the case.
Well, quite. That's a good point. I mean, and when you look at your conversations that you had, for example, I mean, David Cameron, Norma, that, you know, the man who was so central to all of this, what sort of insight has he given you?
David Cameron had pledged to hold a referendum on EU membership for Britain. The top money was that he'd never get the majority that he need to bring it in. And so our story begins on the general election in 2015, where, by gum, he did get a clear majority and Cameron had to bring in a referendum.
It was very difficult because I was a campaigner, but I was also the Prime Minister. And there were, you know, important relationships, whether with Turkey or other European countries, that, you know, you're trying to think, I have to think about these relationships as well as about the campaign.
So the first programme is during the 9 months that he's renegotiating, the various forces are mobilising. Nigel Farage is first off the mark.
Apart from those key figures, Max, who obviously are crucial to that narrative, you also get a new insight from people who were around them at the time, who we don't necessarily hear from, like, for example, Marina Wheeler, who was Boris Johnson's ex-wife, but really crucial to the decision that he made.
Yeah, I think that was really interesting, her role in all of this. Obviously, she was a very experienced barrister and from her professional perspective had seen some issues with the way in which, from her point of view, the European Court of Justice affected her work. And as the story goes on, you know, Marina talks about suggesting to Boris, as he's still undecided, that he goes to his cottage, their cottage in Oxfordshire, and writes 2 articles. And Boris duly does, and he writes an article for Leave, and he calls Marina and reads it through.
It contained what I thought were the fundamental issues about sovereignty, and it was clear that some of what I'd been saying had an impact.
But when he writes the second article, the article for Remain, his sister turns up, and his sister reads the Remain article and says, goodness me, that's really compelling. And I think it's a really interesting insight, which is quite unusual, where you've got these two people who are not in frontline politics looking at the same thing, but from their perspectives. And I think it's a real illustration of sort of confirmation bias, which is largely how the whole country approached this referendum, really, and that you can look at something and you're always going to take away your position on it.
One of the scenes that I really love is Farage organises a flotilla of fishermen come down from the north to lobby Parliament about how the EU is destroying their livelihood. And Bob Geldof, pop singer Bob Geldof, hires an even bigger boat filled with Remainers. What starts off as a propaganda coup for Bob Geldof and the Remainers backfires in his face when the angry fishermen board Geldof's boat.
You're all wrong. And I will stand on his boat and I'll say you are...
Everything in that man's voice, you know, everything, his anger, his rage about his future, the future of his family, everything was wrapped up in his loathing of me and all the people who were trying to stop Brexit.
And the conflict between the anger of the fishermen and the Remainers is just something to see.
It all takes us back to a real moment in time, doesn't it? Norma Percy, the series producer, Max Stern, the series director of Brexit, A Very British Civil War. Thank you for joining us.
And that brings us to 9 minutes to nine. The parents of Natasha Laperouse, who worked tirelessly to improve allergy awareness since their daughter died after suffering a reaction to a Pret baguette that contained sesame but wasn't labelled as such, have launched a new prize in her name. Natasha's prize is going to offer £10 million for allergy research, and I'm delighted to say both parents, Nadim and Tanya as well, are on the line now. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Tell us first of all, Tanya, what is planned? What will the prize do? Where will the money go?
Well, the prize is £10 million over 5 years, and it's the biggest fund, a UK fund ever awarded into food allergy research. And we believe it's a once-in-a-generation opportunity to really find out why we're becoming more and more allergic to food and to actually prevent it. And that's the ambition for this prize.
And Nadim, it is a fact, isn't it, that so far as we understand it at the moment, a child is not born, is never born with an allergy. It is something that happens to you. Is that still our understanding?
It is. That is exactly correct. No child is born with food allergies. However, many children, and there are tens of thousands in the UK, develop food allergies under the age of one, or certainly when they're very young, like a toddler. And that is something that was never in the family, mother or father, before. So it's something completely new as a major health condition that has now entered into the child's life and into that whole family's life. Yeah, nobody's born with food allergies.
And Nadim, you're going to focus on those first 1,000 days, are you? That's what you want the researchers to focus on because of what you've just explained.
Yes, well, there's a number of reasons, but that is the key reason. The first 1,000 days of life are the most opportune moment to have an intervention to change the course of that child's life. It's also important to say when we say the first 1,000 days, we are talking actually about from the moment a woman gets pregnant. So we're talking really from conception to around 2 years of age. That time is when we know, scientists know, that children's immunes are the most plastic. Plastic meaning able to change very quickly one way or another. And then, of course, what we're looking at here is a change to be beneficial. So some kind of intervention that can actually change the course of a child and family's, you know, future, really, in the first 1,000 days is key.
And what will people have to do, Tanya, to get access to the funds in order to do their research? What will they need to show first?
Well, we're asking people from all sorts of disciplines to come together. There's an application that they can go to. We've created a website, natashasfoundation.org.uk. All the information for them is there. And they really need to register their interest by the 3rd of July of this year. And then in the autumn, we'd be bringing people together in what's called a thinkery. And the winner will be announced next June, a year from now. But we're looking at maybe groups of people or individuals. We don't know yet what it's going to look like, but we know that we need to do things differently. I think that's what is really clear. You know, medical research has definitely been moving forward in all sorts of areas. There's been a lot of treatments in allergy, but not everybody can either access them or it doesn't work for everybody. And so, you know, really coming to a point where we can dial it down so that people are no longer at threat of being hospitalized or dying from the food allergies. That's what we're working for those future generations.
What a prize that is, Nadim, and a prize for Natasha.
Yes, indeed. I think it all started for us with Natasha, and we hope we can, in our lifetimes, pretty much end it. That is our wish and our goal. And we both, husband, you know, me and my wife Tanya, Natasha's parents, dedicate the rest of our lives to trying to solve this for millions of people around the world.
Nadim and Tanya, thank you very much for talking to us.
It's 4 minutes to nine. Let's spend the last little bit of the programme this morning in the company of an extraordinary woman, Dr. Shauna Berg, who's become the first woman with stage 4 cancer to reach the summit of Everest. She's an associate professor in exercise and health psychology at the University of Leeds. Dr. Berg, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Thank you for being here. I find this jaw-dropping. Not least, didn't you only get back last night?
That's right. I just arrived last night at 8 p.m. So I'm a bit tired this morning, but it's great to be back in the UK.
I'm sure it is. Well, look, thank you for talking to us. And part of this links into your research and your work, actually, which for a long time has been about the linked impact of cancer and exercise.
That's right. Absolutely. So I've spent 17 years working with both cancer patients as well as multidisciplinary care teams, looking at the impact of exercise on different cancer markers. One of my areas in particular that I focus on is prehabilitation. How do we prepare patients as best as we possibly can, both physically and psychologically, so they're ready to go into major surgery or chemotherapy or radiotherapy?
So you know that a baseline of fitness is a really useful thing, but in your situation now, and stage 4 cancer, for those who don't know, it is an incurable level of cancer. How do you just physically manage to climb a mountain like that?
A lot of preparation went into this. I spent 12 weeks working very closely with colleagues at Leeds Beckett University, where I was training in their high altitude chamber, preparing myself, getting myself prepared to adapt to the low oxygen levels. So when I got to Everest, I was ready to hit the ground running because I did a lot of preparation ahead of time. And so there's a lot that goes into an Everest expedition, not only acclimatizing to the lack of oxygen in the air, but there's also the physical training that goes into it as well. So I spent a lot of time, 4 days a week in the gym. I spent 3 days a week doing aerobic-based exercises. So a lot of preparation is what paid off in the end.
Yeah, it must be a grueling mental challenge as well.
Absolutely. So anytime you go into the mountains, you do know that there is a chance that you don't return home. They're risky. On Everest this year, there were 5 climbers who died on the mountain. And when I left Camp 4 on my way to the summit, I actually did have to walk past 2 bodies, people who had died on the mountain 2 days before I climbed. And so psychologically, that is something that you have to learn how to manage. You need to learn how to deal with that. Also, if you can imagine, there's a lot of discomfort involved when climbing Everest. A lot of side effects of high altitude, shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, headaches. You lose a lot of weight when you're on the mountain because muscles atrophy. And so psychologically, it does become very grueling in terms of how much discomfort can I actually put up with. And I was on the mountain for 5 weeks. So if you can imagine, the body is breaking down over a protracted period of time.
Yeah. I just want to say as we finish, by the way, it's an extraordinary achievement. Your beautiful cat is clearly very pleased to have you back because that's how much I'm watching you.
He's absolutely missed me. And yeah, he's been by my side ever since I got back, which is so lovely. Yeah,
what's his name?
Leo.
Leo. Yeah, I can see that Leo is not...